High Noon and 720 WGN. Yes, we're on at 3 o'clock today because Mother Nature is throwing some sort of hissy fit up in Minnesota, and the Sox game has been postponed. So what is bad for Sox fans and people in Minnesota is good for us because we are here until 7 o'clock. Big show planned. Oh, my goodness. It's always more fun when you get involved. 312-981-7200. That's the phone and the text. When you call in, you'll be talking to Cody. Oh, I'm Mr. Brightside Golf. He is the executive producer from Rockford, Illinois. Try to put a positive spin on that if you can. If you're nice to him, you get to me. That's how it works. Social media, you know it. It's Brian Noonan Show on Facebook and Twitter. And here we are, the Allstate Showcase Studio. As I look out on what can only be described as a mid-November Michigan Avenue. This is insanity. I'm not going to spend a lot of time haranguing about the weather, but this is garbage. I am not happy. I don't think most of us are happy. Even you, Cody, who likes snow, you cannot be happy about
it. I'm happy.
You're happy about this? Cold and rainy?
Yeah, because you know why this happened? Because I got married on October 20th, and it was 76 degrees and sunny.
Yeah, you've screwed us.
The seasons have shifted later, and I am perfectly happy with my beautiful, perfect outdoor wedding in October if we have to pay for it in April and even May.
Wow,
hey,
very
if
special.
It snows a month from now, you know what? I've got great wedding photos.
You are a selfish, selfish man.
I'm over it.
I'm going to be where it's 80 this weekend.
Well,
so I cannot wait. I can't wait to get out of here.
Well, and you're not in very bad shape yourself.
Oh, no, I have to put up with this, as we all do. This is insane.
Yeah.
Now they're talking about there could be snow. It's also tax day. I don't know if you're still waiting. If you thought, April 15th, that date sounds familiar. Is something going on? Is it my anniversary? Perhaps my birthday? No. First day of kindergarten anniversary? I don't think so. Unless you started kindergarten in April, and nobody does that in this country anyway. No, it's tax day. But I guess because it fell on a Sunday, you have until Tuesday, which doesn't make sense to me. But listen, I'm not the federal government, and God knows they need as much help as they can get. So did you do your taxes, Cody? When did you do your taxes?
Filed for an extension.
This morning? You filed for an extension?
Yeah, that's what I do every year.
Really?
I always forget.
How do you... Wait a minute.
I've got a guy.
How do you forget?
He calls
and
every
your guy,
year.
Wait, and your guy doesn't call you sometime prior to April 15th and go, hey, you doing your taxes this year? And you go, nah, whatever. It doesn't cost you anything to do an extension, but then don't you have to pay penalties or anything?
No.
No? You just extend?
No, he emails me a tax organizer in January, and then I reply within a week and say, cool, get it to you right away.
Right.
And then around April 12th, April 13th, I get a call from his office, from his secretary,
sure.
And she says, hey, just noticed you haven't sent us anything. Do you want to file for an extension? And I go, yeah.
Wow.
This is every year for the last, 5 years.
See, and I try to get mine done as early as possible. Because back in the day, I used to get money back. I don't really get money back anymore. But I still try to get them done early. This year, we were late. This year, it was toward the end of March when I finally got my taxes done. I have a lady. I don't have a guy. I have a woman.
Oh, all right.
And this year, I didn't go. This year, I sent the little woman to take the... And I call it that in the most patronizing tone I can. Because that's what we do now in the new day and age. A little woman, I took her away from cooking and cleaning, woman's
wow.
work. And I sent her to go see what the men do with the...
If you're going to commit, hey, go big or go home.
Sure. If I'm going to take one horrible stereotype, I might as well do a whole Mad Men scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I had her put on her pearls and head on out June Cleaver style to the accountant's office. Now, I know she probably didn't understand what accountants do because it's numbers and we all know. All right, I'm going to stop
somebody thinks you're serious.
Before my wife thinks I'm serious.
Hi-o.
Everybody else is going to forget. But yeah, so for years I always went. And then actually the last 2 years, because of scheduling, Debbie has gone to the accountant. Because she used to always say, I would come home from the accountant, or I would actually call her from the parking lot. This was the ritual. I would get to the accountant's office and call her from the parking lot and say, okay, I'm about to go in. Make sure you're near your phone. Because there was always at least one or two questions that I would have or the accountant would have for her as we were going through, our vast fortune, Cody. My estate is, massive. It'd take up a full manila envelope to hold all my assets.
Of course.
A full manila. And I'm not talking a little one. I'm talking a full-size manila envelope.
Oh, like one that'll fit in 8.5 by 11?
Yep, 8.5 by 11. All my vast holdings. But there was always a question about what would happen. So we'd call and Debbie would answer and we'd get that all straightened out. And then I would finish up and I'd go back out to the car and I would call her again and say, okay, it's done. And she would say, what did it cost? Or what are we getting back? what do we have to pay, and what did it cost? So I would answer those questions, and she would always go, you know, we should probably just do it ourselves. And I'd say, okay, let me talk to the accountant, and next year we'll try to do it ourselves. So we'd get close to tax time, and Debbie would say, nah, just go back to the accountant. So I would go into the accountant, and I would say, boy, last year, Debbie, you know, we looked at what it cost, and I'm all for it. Debbie thinks, you know, we should just do TurboTax or something. And my accountant every year would say the same thing. That's fine. She said, do it on TurboTax. I'll even look at it and review it for free. Tell Debbie she can do it herself if she wants, and I'll check it. And then Debbie would see, because, you know, I've always been self-employed, independent contractor. So I've got, you know, our return, again, for our vast holdings, our return is deceptively thick for the numbers that are, you know, included in that return, deceptively thick.
Because you don't elect to have anything withheld, right?
Oh, no, I have withholdings.
Oh, you still do?
Oh,
still
sure, I have withholdings, but I also, when you work for yourself, I've got a lot of write-offs and different things, and, you know, all stuff that, this woman has been my accountant for over 30 years, so, you know, she's kept me out of jail this long. Because I'm an honest American taxpayer. So we pay, but whatever. So every year it's the same thing. Oh, no. And I said, she said you could do it. And she'll even look to make sure we didn't screw it up. Do you really want to do it yourself? And then Debbie will start thumbing through this, you know, 2-inch return and go, yeah, no. I don't want to. That's, you pay a professional. We pay professionals for all sorts of things.
Exactly.
And unless you're doing an easy, I mean, I remember back in the day when I would do my 1040 easy return. Take me 6 minutes, but I also remember watching my dad pore over the taxes for a week at a time, trying to figure it out, till he finally wised up and started going to the same accountant that I used.
Can I address, there's a text message from David in the 630. If you file for an extension, you still need to pay your full taxes on the 17th. That is absolutely not true.
Sure? I thought you had to pay them, though you're...
If
you owe, but you don't owe.
Oh, I don't owe. Well,
then you don't have to worry about it. If you owe money, you have to pay it.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. Yeah. I don't owe money.
You get money back.
Yeah, I get money back. Okay, right. That's fair. But if you file IRS Form 4868, you get an automatic 6-month extension. Usually, I end up paying in
right.
May
that's
or June.
That's to file your claim. That's to file your return. But I believe if you owe money, you still have to send that money in. Like if you knew you owed the IRS, say $1,000.
Sure.
You still have to send them that $1,000 by the 17th. Hmm. You don't have to send your. And I may be wrong if there's some CPAs out there, you know, nothing I like better than to talk ciphering. I love me some number talk. We could we'll get into that, but I'm pretty sure that's right, unless they change the tax code, which they do all the time.
But if you don't do your taxes, then you're not going to know whether you owe money or not.
The governmental catch-22.
Right.
Just send them some cash just in case. Well, most people who owe kind of know they owe money. Because, say you had a big windfall. Let's say you won the lottery. You didn't pay any taxes, but they sent you a check for, you know, 200 grand. Like the years I won on game shows, I knew I owed the government money.
Sure.
Because all of a sudden, I got a check. Like one time, I got a check for 100 grand. And I'm like, woohoo! There was no taxes taken out. Well, I know sometime I got to pay the piper. The piper being the man being the government. The government being Uncle Sam with his fist out, saying, I want you and your cash. So you might want to check into that. But if you don't owe any money, you're fine. All right. People want to know what's on the show. What's coming up on the show? These young ladies outside the Allstate Showcase studio clamoring to know what's on the program today. A brother in sound has died. We'll talk about that next. And then, I went on a field trip. We'll talk about that at 3:30. Dawn Rhodes, this is very, if you or your student, or if you and your high school senior are waiting for acceptance letters and trying to decide where to go to college in the fall, this is going to be a very interesting conversation. Dawn Rhodes is the higher education reporter for the Tribune. She's going to be in here at 4 o'clock. We're going to talk about brain drain and where Illinois students are going to school rather than in Illinois. So we'll talk about that. We'll have a representative from the Irish American Hall of Fame after 5 o'clock. And our good friend Michael Osaki from Baseball in the Attic is going to be here after 6. So if you have any sort of sports memorabilia, whether it's baseball, football, you know what the sports are. I don't have to enumerate them for you, do I? Soccer, lacrosse, badminton, all the big sports. Michael will be able to tell you if what you have may be worth some dough, because now the baseball season has started, people are looking at their baseball card collections and wondering, ooh, Is this worth money, or do I put it in the spokes of my kid's bike? I have absolutely no idea. All right. Now, we're talking about taxes, and a guy who knows all about taxes and financing and MLS numbers and all of that, David Hochberg, who you hear all the time, is with us. He has joined us on the line. Good afternoon, David. How are you?
Good afternoon, Brian. You know I love you and your wife, and all I can say is this, my friend. The investment, it's not a cost. It's an investment. And a great CPA is well worth every single penny.
I have finally gotten her to stop. I've gotten her to stop wondering anymore. She's hook, line, and sinker dedicated to our CPA.
Yes, it's not a cost. It's an investment. That's all. That's the way you have to look at it. Because a good CPA, as you know, Brian, will get whatever the investment that you paid back in multiples of 2, 3, 4, 5. And the creative things that they do with your tax return. And we'll leave it at that.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. So you filed early, I'm sure, David. You're a responsible man. When do you file? Like January 2nd?
No, I filed my extension actually on Friday. I sent in my wonderful checks to the state of Illinois and the wonderful Treasury Department of the United States government. And my account gets my stuff done around September, October, because I have K-1s and partnerships and whatever. So I got stuff still coming back. So I have to file an extension, but still have to pay to make sure that. I made the mistake, though, Brian, one year. I sent the extension in without writing the check.
See?
That was a very costly year. Very, very costly mistake.
That's what I was telling Cody. If you know you owe money, you've got to send that check, even with the extension. You got to send that dough.
To send the check in. I forgot to do that once. And let me tell you, I will never make that mistake again, buddy. Because
you know who doesn't forget?
The IRS does not have a sense of humor.
They do not. They want their money. They're like they're like your big bookie, and you owe them a lot of money. They're coming for their vig, and they want it. They want it. So listen, David. Since we're talking about investment. Real estate still a good investment? Buying a house still the way to go? Is it, for most people, a good investment?
Well, Brian, I say this to everybody. You know, we have rental properties out there, rental apartment buildings, because 65% of Americans own home and 35% rent. So if you're a part of the 35% that don't feel comfortable owning a home, then rent. And you're part of the 65 that have a down payment, a reserve, good credit, a good job, and you want home ownership, it's perfect for you. It's like Baskin-Robbins, buddy. There's different flavor for every day of the month, and home ownership is good for some and not good for others.
It's
good for you. It's something to look at. I've owned homes for the past 20-some years. Investment properties, it's been good for me, but other people, it's not. So you got to make your own decision based upon the different variables that you have in your life.
Well, if people are thinking about getting a mortgage, I know you've dabbled in that for a while, haven't you? That's how would people get a hold of you to take care of that?
Yeah, about 18 years. I think that's a couple years under our belt. I appreciate the opportunity. They call it for the plug, but as long as you're...
I know. Well, since you're here, people know your name. They're like, David Hochberg's here. How do we get a hold of him?
It's very simple. It's very simple, Brian. Your listeners could go to WGNDavid.com. Or they could call us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 312-751-1333. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity, and have a wonderful Sunday, buddy.
Thank you. You too, David. Always good to talk to you. We'll see you soon.
All right, man. Talk soon, bye.
Take care. That's David Hochberg. You hear him all the time here on WGN. He's a good guy, and he knows what he's talking about. All right, let's do this. And then, oh, my goodness, a brother in sound has passed on. And it's always this guy. We'll talk about it after this. WGN. All right. I mentioned that a brother in sound died recently. He died just on Friday. And, of course, I am talking about Art Bell. Did you ever listen to Art Bell, Cody, with Coast to Coast AM? The overnight show that was at one point syndicated on the 500 radio stations. Can you believe that? 500 radio stations.
That's a lot. I'm not familiar.
I used to listen to Art Bell when I was on the road all the time, and I'd be driving home from whatever far-flung location I was doing my shows in, because he was on everywhere. But it was a show about the paranormal, alien abductions, UFOs, and Art Bell would get calls from, and conspiracy theories. Every wacko in the world was calling in. And he handled them beautifully. And he acted as not only his own host, his own engineer, and his own producer. And he broadcast from Las Vegas, but then he started broadcasting from his home in Pahrump, Nevada. You ever been to Pahrump, Nevada? It's known mostly for two things, Art Bell and Houses of Ill Repute. There are a number of brothels in Pahrump, Nevada. It's about an hour from Vegas. So I would listen, and it always freaked me out because Art would take these callers and treat them like he was talking to someone on Meet the Press. Somebody's talking about being abducted by aliens and being probed, and Art is talking to them like he's talking to the chief of staff. So it was very sad. He died at his home on Friday. They're doing an autopsy. He was 72 years old. Coast to Coast AM. He retired from the show in 2002. George Noory took it over, and some other people would do it. He was on Sirius XM for a while, but he was, you know, to be on 500 stations is quite an accomplishment. But it was an overnight show. As I mentioned, ran on Sirius XM in 2013, had a lot of celebrity fans, including, as you can imagine, William Shatner, Josh Groban. They all took to Twitter the other day to try to pay their tributes. One of my best friends was a huge Art Bell fan and would listen to Art Bell every night. And so I was doing a show, actually, at a casino in Pahrump, Nevada. And my buddy was like, you got to find out where Art Bell lives. So I was on stage and I asked the crowd, I said, anybody know where Art Bell lives? And every hand went up because Pahrump is not a big place. So everybody knew where Art Bell lives. And they said, can you go? So I told them, before I leave town in the morning, I'll drive by Art Bell's house. So I go out way outside of town, and I'm going down this road, and people told me it's a cul-de-sac, and it's across the street from the Chicken Ranch. So you'll find, if you see the Chicken Ranch on your left-hand side, you went too far. So I'm driving down this road, and I see up ahead the big sign for the Chicken Ranch, which is a brothel there. And I pull into this cul-de-sac, and there's a ranch house, like a cinder block ranch house, surrounded by fences, and there's antennas everywhere. And his Winnebago with a bunch of antennas is parked in the carport. And I'm on the phone with my buddy as I'm coming down the street. And I'm like, oh, here it is. And I turn into the cul-de-sac. I got in front of Art Bell's house with all these antennas. Signal went dead. I don't know if Art was like cell blocking. I don't know what technology he had in the bunker, but something was crazy. So I take a couple pictures. This is when I actually had to use a camera. I take some pictures and I pull out of the cul-de-sac and I pulled into the parking lot across the street. It was a brothel, but it was a parking lot across the street. Now my signal is back and I call my buddy. I'm like, this is so weird. In front of Art Bell's house, I don't know. The aliens must have blocked the signal. So I didn't get to meet Art, but I fear if I had stayed outside his residence too long, there would have been an armed encounter. I don't know if he was a survivalist, but I know, because he dealt with the kind of people he dealt with, there were some threats and craziness that went on in his life. But Art Bell, very, very successful, and I'm sure people listening to this were big fans of his as well. So rest in peace, Art Bell. We got a quick comment from Pete on Art. Hello, Pete.
Yes, real quick. I just want to say something about Art Bell. I used to listen to that show overnight. I was in the Navy 24 years, so you got this syndicated radio and stuff. I really think guys like Art Bell and Larry the Legend Johnson and even some of the all-nighters, in the old days, nobody had cable TV or whatever, so he probably saved a lot of people because he would treat every caller like if they were totally true. They would talk about shadows, people on the wall, everything. So he was like, okay, that's cool, that's cool. He might have saved them from their own psychosis, and who knows how many lives he saved just being on overnight talking to people.
I don't doubt it, Pete. He definitely had an audience, and if you had an outlet, if that was what you were thinking, if that was what you believed, you had an outlet that Art provided. Pete, thanks for the call. We got to get to the news. It is 3:30 on 720 WGN. With that news, here is Pam Jones. Brian Noonan, WGN. Yes, we are here on time this week. Full show coming up after 6. If you have any sports memorabilia around your house and you're wondering what it might be worth, our good friend Michael Osaki from baseballintheattic.com will be in studio. He'll be taking your calls to appraise your sports memorabilia. I hope Roger brings something in. That was so much fun last time Michael was here and Roger brought in what he thought were treasures, And that and is usually the case. Most of us get shot down with our treasures. That's why I don't have treasures. Except for my lovely wife and daughter. And my relationship with you, Cody.
Thanks.
There, I have smooched everybody's behind. And now it's time to move on to the more pessimistic part of me. No, that's not true. So I started a new, if you remember, if you're a regular listener to the program, last semester, from September to December, I was in a long-term subposition teaching first grade. Well, during that time, I was approached by one of the second grade teachers in this school who I've known for a couple years, and she said, hey, I'm going on maternity leave right after spring break. Would you be interested in taking my class for the remainder of the year? And because I'm soft in the head, I said, of course, I would love to take your second grade class. And I will say, I just finished my first week as a second grade teacher, Cody, and I did pretty well. It's a good group of kids, so, you know, but Mr. Noonan don't play. This is a lesson that all the children learn right away. I do not play. They're a pretty well-behaved class, but being second graders, they're goofy sometimes. And they do, you know, some extra talking or some goofing around that they know they shouldn't do. And this teacher is big on not, you know, there's different behavior methods, classroom management methods that teachers use nowadays. Back when I was in school, it was basically a punch in the face and you sat in the hall. That was how we were disciplined in school, and it worked well. Look how much respect I have for academia after being treated that way. However, and now my mom is probably thinking, really? Who punched you? Well, at Ignatius, the priest would throw punches nonstop. But anyway, when I was, so instead of doing, now a lot of them have cards, so red, green, and yellow cards. And if your card is on green, that means you're doing, oh, you're making good choices all day. And then if you have to flip your card to yellow, well, you got to think about it. And if you flip your card to red, well, that means you got to, you know, you got to get a note home or something. So that's one way, and there's people argue about it different. Anyway, this teacher has been teaching these kids all year that actions have consequences, which I think is a lesson that is wonderful. Most people need to learn that lesson, and second grade is not too young to have that lesson taught to you. So these kids are pretty good, and they know that if they do something really out of bounds, that the consequence is normally, for minor infractions, 5 minutes on the wall at recess. So you go out for recess and you have to stand on the wall for 5 minutes, and then you get the rest of the recess. So you're not missing your recess, which I think is important for kids. They need to run around and get some of that excess energy out. But they also realize I can't make certain choices and behave certain ways. I have to toe the line. So I've already put a couple kids on the wall. I'm not going to lie to you. First day, I dropped somebody on the wall. 5 minutes. Second day, had to put somebody on the wall. And I give them warnings, and I give them chances. So, but the assistant principal, who's a lovely woman, noticed on Tuesday, and she jokes around with me. I see her in the afternoon. She goes, wow, Mr. Noonan putting people on the wall already, second day. And I said, listen, I'm not goofing around. Already, you know, these kids got to know. So I started, they started getting a little goofy toward the end of the week. So I instituted a new rule. So I have the wall list. If I have to warn you once, your name goes on the list. That's your first warning. Two more strikes, you're on the wall. I have a lot of kids with one strike, but they all wised up. They didn't get three. But so I'm trying. I got to be that classroom management. But Wednesday, so my first week in second grade, Wednesday, my very third day. Yeah, I'm good at teaching English and speaking and stuff. Third day in second grade was field trip day. You remember field trip day, Cody? The most exciting day of the scholastic year is field trip day.
Incredible.
Bar none. Field trip day, you look forward to as soon as that permission slip goes home. The night before, you can't sleep. It's like Christmas. Field trip day. And when I took this position, they said, oh, you got to go on the field trip. And the teachers hate field trips. Teachers detest field trips. One, because you're in a non-controlled environment. And you're terrified that you're going to lose a kid. Because I can't really lose them in school. They've got to be somewhere in the building. The perimeter is locked down. There's only so much area that they could wander off into. But once you leave, oh, man. Once you leave the environs of school, one, you're getting on a bus, you're traveling somewhere, then it's a logistical nightmare for teachers. But the kids love it. So this field trip was to Legoland in Schaumburg. I've never been to Legoland. I know the original one is in California, and kids love Legos. So the kids are all excited from Monday, first thing. Well, first they asked if their teacher had the baby, and I said that she did, and I showed them some pictures. After that, it was, you know, Mr. Noonan, day after tomorrow's field trip day. Field trip day is coming up Wednesday, Mr. Noonan. It's field trip day. I said, I know. I can't. I'm very excited. And I'm, you know, because I'm talking to a seven-year-old, so I'm adopting my kindly voice, which you never get to hear here, but I have it. I have a Mr. Noonan can talk to seven-year-olds and not terrify them voice. So I'm like, oh, I understand. It's going to be a lot of fun. Wednesday comes, and now, first of all, there's a whole thing, a million questions from the kids, a million. The biggest one is the day before, I'm reminding them that they have to bring a sack lunch. And it's got to be everything that can be thrown away. Well, there's like 47 questions. Well, can it be in a plastic bag? Yes. Can it be in a paper bag? Yes. Should I have my name on it? Yes. What if I bring this? You can't. What if I wanted to do this? Well, you can't. So it's got to be in a plastic bag? No, it can be in a paper bag. Can it be in a paper bag too? Yes, I told you it can be in a paper bag. Seven-year-olds ask a lot of questions. They don't listen to the answers, so they just repeat the questions. So we get... The bus comes on Wednesday morning. We're all very excited. Have you ever been on a bus with 47-year-olds? Not 47-year-olds. Most of them are just talking about how sore their hips are and, you know, what vitamins and how a spin class. But 47-year-olds, the noise level on this bus, you could drive hostage takers out of a building. If I had piped the noise from this bus... I could have diffused many military situations. It was a cacophony of shrieks and screams, and some repetitive. A lot of 7-year-olds like to make repetitive sounds. La 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 la. 45 minutes on the bus. La 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 la. Thankfully, there were the chaperones from my class. And another teacher and a couple of her chaperones. And so she took the lead of, stop that. But they were still very loud. And I had lists made for each of my chaperones. Here are the five kids in your group and your group and my group. But that doesn't negate the fact that I was terrified that one of these kids was going to wander off. One, because they do. Seven-year-olds just wander off. And I'm telling the chaperones, okay, here's what we're going to do. And I'm trying to remember, this is supposed to be fun, not a military exercise. So, fun. We got to have fun, right? And it is. Legoland is amazing. If you've never been and you like Legos, there was a huge Star Wars room that you would have loved. It was everything was there. The Millennium Falcon, Darth Vader, R2-D2, everybody was, oh man, it was crazy. And there's a jungle. It was beautiful. And then there's play. So everything's going fine. Part of the amazing thing to me with seven-year-olds is their ability to not be in the moment. The minute we got to Legoland, which was the goal of the entire day, to get to Legoland, I'm not exaggerating, 4 minutes in.
Is it time for lunch?
No, it's 9:30. We don't eat lunch till 11:55 anyway.
Is it lunchtime?
No. Let's go enjoy ourselves.
Okay, but when are we going to have a lunch?
We're not having lunch till after we're done.
Oh, when are we done?
Just go. Enjoy Legoland. Well, here's a thing that I don't remember this when I was a kid. Maybe it's a different generation. When you were young, Cody, and you were going on field trips with school, if your parents weren't chaperones, would they show up? Would they just come along, like meet you at the zoo or wherever your field trip was?
I don't think so.
Me either. This was something brand new. So I have my chaperones, but the teacher that I'm in for had picked the chaperones, and I had them. But then there were other parents, like five other parents, who just drove themselves up to Legoland to be part of the field trip.
Maybe one or two would do that.
Yeah, I see. That was all new to me. I didn't realize that was a thing. And it was, I guess, it was fine. I guess they want to be with their kids, but then they're pulling their kids kind of away from the group, and you know, there's no part of the deal is you go and we go and have lunch, and we're not supposed to have snacks and treats and everything. And the teachers know that, and the official chaperones kind of knew that. But there were a couple chaperones who were buying treats and all kinds of stuff for their group. And then the other groups were like, because there's four second grade classes. And then the other groups were like, oh, how come they get treats and we don't? And it caused a whole big thing. But we'll take a quick break. And then I will tell you how I became the bad guy of the field trip real quickly. Because as you can imagine, I was doing pretty good. Everything was going fine. And then Mr. Noonan was cast as the bad guy. Yes. How? Well, you'll find out after this. Somebody texted in at 312-981-7200. I've been saying seven-year-olds in second grade. Somebody, aren't they primarily eight-year-olds in seventh grade? I guess. Does that change the story if they're eight? So anyway, we're at Legoland, and now this is how I became the bad guy. So after Legoland, which was great, they had a really cool thing where we sat in with a Legoland person, and they had the kids do an experiment making tops out of Legos, and they had to, before they made the tops, they had to predict which top was going to spin longer. It was very cool. But anyway, now it's time to get the kids out and back on the bus. Three buses, four classrooms of 8-year-olds. Some are seven, some might be, I don't know, second graders. This is where, again, my heightened panic mode kicks in, because I'm trying to keep my 20 together. I actually had 19. One was sick. One girl, sick. Missed the field trip. How awful is that? The one day you're sick is field trip day. So now I've got my... And I'm trying to be nice yet firm with the chaperones. All right, we got to get our kids here. We're going to do this. And I'm trying to get a picture of the group so I can send the picture to the teacher who's not there. So we get all that done. I get them on the bus. Now, we were going under the expressway from Legoland to Bussy Woods, and we were going to picnic. So thank goodness Wednesday the weather was cooperating. I envisioned us going to like a picnic area in the woods, you know, with the canopy that covers a cement pad with picnic tables in there. That was what I figured we were going to do because it's safer. No, we pull up to the Bussy Woods fishing ramp, which is adjacent to a lake. Concrete sidewalk with about a 4-foot drop straight into the water. Only a rail in one little section. So a lot of open waterfront for my 7/8-year-olds to go diving into. So I see this, and I'm immediately like, oh, no, this is a bad idea. And I say to one of the other teachers, did you know we were going to be by a lake? And she's like, no, I didn't know we were going to be by a lake. So we get out of the bus, and there's a huge open field, and the kids, they get their lunch out of the bins, and they all start running. And I'm like, oh, and I'm trying to keep your eye on 19 second graders who are now intermingling with 60 other second graders. Horrifying. They're screaming and they're running, and I get them down to like two picnic tables scattered around the field. So I get them to the picnic tables and we're eating. Well, I'm not going to sit down to eat because being a parent, I've got one eye on my turkey sandwich and my other eye is scanning the waterfront because I know these kids trip over nothing in school. So the thought of them falling into a lake, and as nice as it was on Wednesday, I wasn't going in the lake after them. I'm a sub. This is a job for a certified teacher. You want to be a hero, don't call Mr. Noonan, because he's kind of just along for the ride. Call somebody else. But oh no. So I kind of position myself near the water. And kids are doing what kids do. They're running down right to the edge, and they're pretending to push each other in. And so all of a sudden I become the lakefront traffic cop. I'm like, back up to the wall. And the kids are looking at me like, man, what a jerk. And all I could think of was one of these kids going in because they're leaning over. And then, of course, a couple of the parents take their kids right down. And Cody, I'm not exaggerating. No rail. It's a straight drop off. It's like walking the plank. Bloomp, into the water. There was no way I was letting a kid go in that lake. And the rest of the teachers are way up by the buses. And I'm thinking, somebody please come and help me. The kids are running. And so I'd walk down along the lake and I'd shoo some kids away, and the minute I turned my back, there were other kids down at the other end. So I'm like running back and forth, and the parents are, you know, taking their kids to the edge. And then I heard one dad go, "We better back up. I guess Mr. Noonan doesn't want us near the water." And I'm about to go, "GD Wright, I don't want you near the water. You know, you're with your kid. You'll go in after your kid. Don't expect us to go in after all that. I don't want there to even be a problem." So, and the picnics seemed to go on an inordinate amount of times. Like, the teachers had no desire to get back to school, which, you know, I don't blame them. We're out and about. We're doing things. I don't need that happening. But, oh, my God, it was the most terrifying thing ever. So I get them. I keep everybody out of the water. We get back on the bus. I thought, well, this will be great because they've been running around. These kids are going to sleep on the way back. It was louder on the ride home than it was on the ride to Legoland. Except one kid did fall asleep. It was the kid who was sitting next to me, and I was his pillow. So he's using Mr. Noonan as his lazy boy, and everybody else is just screeching. And then because we're coming back on the Eisenhower, we got caught in traffic. I'm glad the kids got to go on the field trip. I enjoyed Legoland, but I don't really need to be going on field trips.
So you became the villain because you wouldn't let anybody near the lake?
Because I wouldn't let anybody near the water. I was the villain.
Huh.
Somehow that doesn't seem right. Somehow you would think as a responsible adult, I would be lauded for my real dedication to keeping children safe. And yet that was not the case. Suddenly I was the black hat. I was the man who, listen, if a kid wants to fall in the lake, it's field trip day. They should be allowed to fall in the lake. Why is Mr. Noonan putting a damper on their fun? Who is this guy to come in and suddenly say that our children can't fall in the lake? But that was the role I was cast as. Villain. Field trip villain.
That's rough. And we got a text. I'm a teacher of 22 years. Every year we go to the Elgin Symphony by the Fox River. I'm laughing hysterically at your story. It's no different after 22 years and with fifth graders.
Fifth graders, I'm thinking, maybe can swim. But, yeah, it's... my daughter wants to know, what university or college did you attend? It wasn't for journalism. How did you gain your radio? I went to Southern Illinois, and I got my degree in radio TV. And how did I don't know. I just like to talk a lot. Roger's here. You're early.
I had an errand to run. I got it done early.
Sure. And you heard, your ears perked up. You heard a school story, and you're like, I got to get there.
All the way in.
How many field trips did you go on in your illustrious career? Do high schools go on field trips?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. In fact, there's money set aside, and towards the end of the year, principals tell you
must gotta go.
You gotta go. We can't waste this money.
Was I lying to say teachers are not enamored of the field trip?
You got that right.
All right.
Because while you didn't have to worry about getting a sub for your students, or say a student who missed the bus, so to speak.
Yes.
But we had to. If I only was taking, because I had sophomores, juniors, and seniors.
Right.
So if I was only taking my seniors, I had to get people to cover my sophomores and junior class, but the school didn't have money for
the subs.
So you had to get other teachers to cover your classes.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh.
And the other kids, of course, they said, oh, yeah, we're going. The other class is going on a field trip. We don't have to do anything.
We won't have to do anything.
Oh, no, because... Does Mr. Noonan play?
No.
No, Mr. Noonan does not play.
Mr. Baddish probably didn't play either.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, if there's a reason you're not going on the field trip, you don't get to enjoy your day.
No.
There was one second grader who didn't get to go on the field trip.
Oh.
Not in my class. All my kids.
They all showed up.
Yeah. Oh, well, the one girl was sick. But, all right. Would you say that I was villainous in my behavior keeping children from drowning? And now I'm escalating it, Cody. I saved 80 children from drowning that day. On Wednesday. I think there should be some award.
You're a saint.
Yes, thank you, Roger. Canonization is right down the road. Somehow I will win some education award, despite the fact that I am only a certified sub, and I haven't put in the time or the energy or the effort to become a certified teacher. But I still think my behavior should be recognized.
Yes.
And not vilified.
No,
would you
not
agree?
At all. I think you saved the children from their own... disastrous desires.
Those children make bad decisions on a moment-to-moment basis.
Yes.
There is no doubt about it.
Now, you have
We have
second
20
graders.
Seconds. Yes.
It doesn't change when they are in high school.
Good. Except they probably, the second graders probably listened a little better than high school kids would when I told them to get away
from
the water.
Yeah, they would, because they know that the parents would get after them if you had to tell the parents. But when you tell a high school student on a TV set, don't touch that and don't sit there, that's a challenge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Somebody asked, how many times did I count heads? I must have counted to 1978 times that day. How many do I have? Okay, good. Stand over here. 19. Good. Stand over here. All right, get on the bus. Get off the bus. Then they get on the bus. I count them again.
Yep.
We're on the bus. Like suddenly they were going to get sucked out of the bus by some mysterious force. I'm counting again on the bus.
Did getting you off the bus. The kids that lie down on the seat?
Sit up
so I can count
sit
you.
Up so I can count you. Yeah, stand right here. Don't move. I got to count you. All right. On the speaking of kids and education and things, Dawn Rhodes is going to join us after the news. She is the higher education reporter for the Chicago Tribune. There is a brain drain going on in Illinois, and you may be surprised where all those brains are draining to. So we'll talk to her about what Illinois universities can do to keep some of our best and brightest right here in the state. But right now, it is time for the news. Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. If you have a smart speaker, just say, hey, man, play WGN Radio on TuneIn. It is 4 o'clock with the news. Here's Pam Jones. It is the time of year when high school seniors are waiting on the edge of their seats for their acceptance letters. Did they get into the college of their choice? Then the decision as where to go. And it always comes down to when you're discussing with your parents, can you study what you want to study at this university? Do you like when you took the tour, did you like the dorms? Did you like the people there? And the big thing is cost. How much do schools cost? We all know we've talked about student debt on this program many, many times. Kids are graduating from school. I say kids because they, to me they still are. Coming out saddled with this unbelievable debt. Well, the other thing is we have some very brilliant high school seniors in Illinois, and they're not staying in Illinois. And it's causing what is being called a brain drain. Dawn Rhodes is the higher education reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and she is in the studio with me now. Dawn, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So this has the brain... Explain what brain drain is, first of all, if I misquoted it. And how long has this been growing in... as a problem?
Sure. The brain drain is something that higher education leaders in the state frequently refer to as exactly what you said, the trend of Illinois' best and brightest students leaving the state to go to college. So in the way of statistics, back in 2002, about 71% of Illinois high school graduates stayed in state to go to college, and 29% left. That proportion is a little bit closer to about half and half now. So the jump between 2002 and 2016, when the last data came out, was about 73% increase of students leaving the state. So yeah, it's a pretty significant trend.
Now we can point to cost, but the cost can't be the only thing. What as you've looked at these numbers, besides money, what are other reasons that so many kids are leaving? And because I thought Illinois had a pretty good university system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The quality of Illinois' higher education system, from the families that I've spoken to, really isn't the issue.
Okay.
Cost is a really big issue. And along around that same period, tuition has skyrocketed, as mm-hmm. any parent and, anyone who has a kid in college or used to have a kid in college could tell you. Tuition has really skyrocketed, so the cost of attendance really is a big deal. But also a big issue is available scholarship money and the amount that, so in higher education, you talk about the sticker price of college, which is the posted price that you see, and then the real cost, which is once you deduct all the financial aid, how much are you actually, your family actually paying to go to school? And scholarship offers, especially in surrounding states across this country, have gotten much more aggressive, much more, the way that higher education leaders will say that they're designed to poach Illinois students. And so they've definitely gotten much more generous. And if you're a family, if you're a middle-class family, upper-middle-class family, if you don't qualify for need-based financial aid, but obviously you don't make enough to just pay $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for college. If your kid gets a really generous scholarship offer at a decent state university or a private school, why would you not consider that? And right now it's becoming a point where families can't pass that up, and kids don't want to pass that up.
And it's also, it seems Illinois is an island, because I know 4 years ago when we were visiting schools, one of the schools we went to was University of Missouri.
Sure.
To check things out. Yeah. And they had, Missouri has a cooperation with a number of states where after the first year, students can qualify, and they laid this out at the first orientation tour, become in-state residents.
Sure.
So suddenly you're paying in-state tuition on top of any merit-based scholarships and everything else you're getting. We know Illinois' budget is in a horrible situation. Is that part of the reason that the school, or is that the only reason these schools don't have the scholarship money to try to lure, to why can't we be poaching from Iowa and Indiana and everybody else?
Sure. Part of it is, it's a good thing that you mentioned these kind of state-to-state cooperations, and Illinois definitely, at least according as of 2016, Illinois state schools don't participate in those kind of cooperative agreements as much as Missouri, Wisconsin, and other Midwestern schools. So whether I haven't really looked into whether or not that, how significant of a factor that is, but it's got to figure in somewhat.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Is it all this, the fact that the state budget is in such a mess that the schools don't have that money to offer these scholarships?
It's not so much an issue of don't have, but most Illinois state schools, especially University of Illinois, they've weighted their financial aid more in favor of need-based financial aid. That's the priority for a lot of state schools. And that's actually a larger debate that I got into when I was writing my story, was that state schools kind of have this, kind of have to wrestle with the idea of what is the purpose of a state public land grant institution.
Right.
Is it primarily to educate local in-state students? Is it primarily to get a nice mix of in-state students, out-of-state students, international students, and structuring scholarship money that way? So what you'll see is, so one school in particular, University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Yes.
They realized that other states, especially in the Midwest, are using what we call merit aid or non-need-based financial aid as a way to attract students from Wisconsin. So they realized they needed to up their merit aid to play the game and just to make sure that they stay competitive. Another, by contrast, University of Kentucky went the exact opposite way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they, as recently, I think 2016 or 2015, they had their ratio of non-need-based financially versus need-based was 90% in favor of merit aid.
Okay. Merit aid, for those who might not know, if your student has a grade point average above this point, or if they've scored higher than this on the standardized test, they're just, hey, here's some money. I know that those are the kind of scholarships my daughter got at Tulane. It was, okay, thankfully she had worked hard. One of the knocks I've heard a lot about University of Illinois is that they don't cough up for in-state kids who have really high GPAs, kids who are accepted at U of I, but then they're not getting the packages that they can get everywhere else.
Exactly. And almost all of the students that I spoke to for my recent story about the growing trend of students leaving the state said the same thing, is that they applied to U of I, or they applied to UIC or Illinois State or whatever other big in-state school and couldn't get, these are kids that were at the top of their class, 4.0 GPAs or near perfect GPAs, and they couldn't get anything from those schools. And so they went shopping for a better deal, essentially. And that was definitely a big factor in their decision to leave.
Well, let's talk about the story, because I found one of the places that is really benefiting from Illinois students leaving is a place, to be honest, one of the last places I would have expected to hear, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So the University of Alabama, Roll Tide, they are they up their game, and they are poaching a lot of Illinois students. How did they do it, and how has it changed from before to now, where they're grabbing a lot of our best and brightest?
Yeah, sure. Over the last decade, about 2007, they had maybe 150 Illinois students at University of Alabama. Now they have over 1,600. So you're talking about more than a tenfold increase in one decade. Now, Illinois is not the largest source of out-of-state students for the University of Alabama, but it's definitely the largest outside of the South.
Okay. Yeah, you expect people from the South to go to Alabama. Like in the Midwest, we go to Iowa or Wisconsin or something like that. So that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. But definitely it stands out as they attract students from California, from all over as well. But, definitely is the largest outside of the South. And that kind of increase from one state, and also their overall out-of-state enrollment has really exploded over the last 10, 15 years as well. Part of what happened with the University of Alabama is not all that different from what Illinois faces now. They knew that they were going to start seeing the state support and state funding for public higher education go down. So they knew that they were going to have to change their financial model in order to be sustainable. And one simple way of doing it, is going after out-of-state students who pay more tuition.
Sure.
And that's exactly what they did. So
The out-of-state students do pay higher tuition. Does it balance out when they're giving all these, or how does it balance out when they're giving all these scholarships?
So not all the students who go to University of Alabama are getting full scholarships.
Right.
So some of them are getting, a great deal of them are getting full tuition scholarships.
That's amazing.
Yeah, which covers about $18,000, $20,000, but they still have to pay for room and board.
Sure.
They're still paying for books.
Right.
They're still paying for, different fees, football, things like that. So there's definitely income being generated.
Can I, and I know you quoted it in the story, but for those who haven't read it yet, you need to get to ChicagoTribune.com and read Dawn Rhodes' story about the brain drain and everybody going to Alabama. What do students need in order to qualify for one of these, I'll pay the room and board and the fees and all that to get 4 years of tuition. That's amazing.
Yeah, so their requirements are pretty stringent, and they've definitely gone up as more students have taken advantage of it. But minimum is a 3.5 GPA. Okay. I forget the exact cutoff for ACT and SAT scores.
I think you said 32.
Yeah, it's about a 32.
32 for the ACT.
It's about a 32. But you can get anywhere from about $20,000 over 4 years to full tuition over 4 years, which is a little bit more than $100,000. So, plus there might be some other benefits built into that as well. But
so if your kid is a sophomore, tell them to get cracking.
That's right.
You've still got time. You've still got time to up that GPA. And then take a prep class for the test.
Sure.
It's worth it down the road. So, all right. So Alabama is looking at their funding going down, their enrollment leaving. Mm-hmm. They decide, all right, we have to up our game. We have to start poaching. What did they do to the camp? Because, Tuscaloosa is probably a hard sell to some kid in Naperville, but they must have done some things to make not only financially it attractive, mm-hmm. but everything else.
Yeah, so one thing that they also did is they really heavily invested in some new dorms, new facilities, updated classrooms, and things like that. And that is the thing that, across the board, every student and every parent that I talked to from Illinois that is now at Alabama, they said the same thing. It is the most beautiful campus that they have ever seen. And these are kids who kind of have their pick of the litter.
Sure.
And they went all over the country. As soon as they got to Alabama, they were blown away with how well maintained it was. There's a lot of new dorms that have kind of the suite styles that kids like nowadays. So that's definitely part of it. They're building new dorms constantly. One student told me that out-of-state students basically keep the construction and the construction business in Tuscaloosa going year-round.
Sure.
So there's every time they go around, they can see what they say. They can see their money at work. They can see something new being built. They can see something being updated. So that was part of it as well. In addition to investing in these scholarships.
And when the kids are coming down, how is University of Alabama ranked as a national university? Is it worth it to say, these kids who, as you mentioned, had the pick of the litter, to say, I'm getting free tuition, but is it free tuition at, you know,
sure,
a junior college, or is it free tuition? We know they're a football powerhouse. Are they an educational powerhouse too?
That's part of the reason. That's part of the reason for why they wanted to attract these really high achieving students is okay. because they want to boost their academic yeah. profile as well. So they're not known just as a football powerhouse. I don't have the U.S. News and World Report rankings off the top of my head, but a lot of parents that I talk to, these are, you know, these are working professionals. These are
sure.
people who have science backgrounds. They have kids who are going into engineering. So they are very well versed in the quality of education and what they think their kids need to know in order to walk away with a degree that means something. And they all say the same thing. They're so pleased with what their kids are learning. And so they feel completely confident in the quality of the education, whatever the ranking is, you know, so especially for the kids who are majoring in engineering, which, as we know, is one of the bread and butter programs at U of I. They're so thrilled with the quality of education their kids are getting. And they parents told me about all these great internships that their kids are getting and great summer jobs
that
they already have lined up. So they're extremely pleased with the quality of education.
Well, and you know, when you go to a university with such a huge athletic program, you've got a very strong alumni base.
Yes.
You've got people who will do the hiring of graduates, which is, you know, a lot of universities, that's one of the things they push. Hey, our alums really hire our graduates. Are there other, as you were researching this story, are there other universities that are starting to follow the Alabama model and say, oh, wow, they did it right. We need to start doing that.
Sure. Yeah. I didn't find a university that had necessarily the same growth in numbers,
okay.
and so that may just be, I don't know what it is, but parents wrote to me and said, oh, South Carolina's doing this.
Okay.
I have a kid at Ole Miss who did this. I have a kid, I heard from one parent who told me they have one child at University of Hawaii and one, I
That's
think.
That's rough.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
What a horrible setting.
Oh, no.
And then one, gosh, where is she? I think in Wyoming? Or somewhere in Wyoming or Montana, but some school.
The polar opposite, no pun intended.
Exactly, but some school that you would not think of.
Okay.
But Colorado, I'm from Colorado. CU Boulder is is seeing some growth among Illinois students. So, yeah, and then Nebraska was one that some college counselors brought up to me. So, yeah, I don't have those numbers in front of me,
but others are
there.
Following this path.
Yeah, the secret is out, as one college counselor told me about the quality of Illinois students. So
before I let you go, Don, the obvious question is then, what can Illinois' higher education system do if we're losing all these kids to other places? And as you mentioned at the beginning, they're not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
How do we keep them here?
I think that, honestly, that's the big question that higher education and leaders and legislators are really grappling with. And I don't know that there's really one simple answer to that,
okay.
because a lot of the factors that feed into this trend are separate but related.
Yeah.
So you have the issue of tuition. Well,
mm-hmm.
you can't just cut tuition to a competitive level, because most of these schools really, that's their primary source of income.
Yeah.
And if state appropriations aren't going to rise up to the level that they once were, well, so you're cutting into your major source of income if you just lower your tuition. So that's not financially sustainable. But so that's part of the problem. Scholarships are definitely part of the issue, too. And University of Illinois has said that they know that they kind of need to step up their game, and they need to figure out how to offer better deals. And they're focusing more on in-state students. They're focusing more on recruiting in areas that they haven't recruited quite as heavily before, like Western Illinois, Southern Illinois. They're partnering. Some of these state schools are partnering with each other on recruiting to say, if you don't come to our school, at least, you know, consider this one.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And one of the executive director of the Board of Higher Education told me that, you know, I mentioned sticker price and the net cost of college, that universities, especially the ones that have had big enrollment losses over the last several years, really need to do a better job at promoting how much the real cost of college is. And that's a thing that will help with recruitment, he feels. So
I remember the first time, one of the first college visits we went on, they used the term sticker price, and it immediately made an impact. It
yes.
was like, oh, okay, I get it. Nobody's paying sticker.
Exactly.
So you got to figure out how much, like buying a car, how much below sticker you can get this for.
Exactly. So, and beyond that, I mean, you know, there's a lot of grappling on the state level and among state legislators to figure out, like, do there need to be some broader reforms in just the way higher education is offered in Illinois? There are a couple of legislators who are wondering, pushing proposals that would involve, you know, more evaluation of the programs each school is offering and whether or not those programs are getting strong enough enrollment to kind of justify that being offered, justify the cost of being offered. So there's just lots of different discussions happening about how do we combat this. And there's a lot of different factors at play to address that feed into this issue. So it's not a simple answer.
No, but it's definitely something that needs to be addressed sooner rather than later.
Absolutely.
As we watch kids wander off. And I'm guilty of it. My daughter went out of state, but...
So did I. I'm from Colorado, so...
I stayed in state. Down at Southern, where they're doing what you said, talking about merging schools and getting rid of programs and the redundancy. We got to get it out and, you know, beef up the enrollment because they went through a period of, hey, we're going to try to be something for everybody. And because of that, standards dropped. People who went to college who maybe could have benefited from community college for a couple of years before they went to a university. So it's happening not just at Southern, but all over the state. And, Dawn, we're going to keep reading your stuff. I know you'll keep covering. This was fascinating. And, again, Tuscaloosa, if you had given me anywhere to guess in the United States, where are the brightest Illinois students going? I don't know, Virginia, somewhere out east? Nope, Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Yeah, it was shocking for me, too.
Well, very nice to meet you. Thank you for
Likewise.
Coming in. We'll talk again. You can read Dawn Rhodes in the Tribune. Go check this out. Growing brain drain, University of Alabama's gain in drawing Illinois students is a loss for Illinois. And not a good, there's no good loss, but this one is troubling and could go on for quite some time. So make sure you check out Dawn in the Tribune. All right, let's do this. Then there's more. It's WGN. Cody must be sleepy. He's playing all sorts of crazy music to get us jacked up. Playing some Motorhead. You like Lemmy? Big things on his face. Do you even know who Motorhead is?
Yes, I know who Motorhead is.
Do you?
Lemmy was good friends with Triple H from the WWE, and that's why he did Triple H's entrance music.
How excited were you last week watching WrestleMania from the Big Easy?
Does that mean home?
No, that means it was in New Orleans.
Oh!
Wow.
You know what?
You didn't even know where it was.
I knew it was in, I knew it was in New Orleans. I just didn't know they call it the Big Easy.
Really?
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. I don't understand half of what's going on.
Let me ask you this, Ronda Rousey. I heard from the tweets and things the next day, she made a triumphant debut. Is that correct? Would you say that? Why is she wearing Rowdy Roddy Piper's old uniform?
She was a huge fan of Rowdy Roddy Piper and befriended him, I think, before he passed away. And he was her inspiration for all of the stunts that she did during the UFC to become so popular.
Oh.
She built that character and she learned from him because Rowdy Roddy Piper was the first.
Piper's Pit, the whole big deal.
Right, he was one of the first big pro wrestlers that really knew how to market himself.
Yeah.
You know, just be a character and all that. And she learned from him. And anyway, she met with his son a little bit before WrestleMania, and he gave
Bob Rowdy?
I don't know. he gave her Piper's old jacket.
Okay.
And so when she actually this was when she first debuted like in January.
Right. I remember her wearing the jacket.
She wore that. So and she was introduced actually in her last few UFC fights as Rowdy Ronda Rousey because she asked Roddy Piper for that permission. So she's always been really into it.
Okay, cool.
And that carried over to WWE. So now her merchandise and all her graphics and the commentators stop themselves. You can tell they're, I think, contractually obligated to call her Rowdy Ronda Rousey. It's not just Ronda Rousey.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, nice. I'm a big Ronda Rousey fan, and I was extremely nervous for this, and I expected it to be a trash fire, and it was possibly the most entertaining match of
really?
The night.
Really? Who did she wrestle? Oh, Stephanie McMahon, right?
It was Rowdy Ronda Rousey and Kurt Angle.
Right.
Olympic gold medalist versus...
Mr. Perfect. Is he still Mr. Perfect?
No. Mr. Perfect was Kurt Hennig.
Oh.
Good. Close, though.
Mr. Somebody.
Very close, right. And they were in a tag team match against Triple H and Stephanie McMahon Helmsley. And it was... Dude, it was great.
All right.
It was great. She's... If she continues to perform at that level, she'll be real good to watch.
The most exciting thing about it was you didn't have to take the day off. Because we're off more than we're here now. So we're basically is there a level below part timer?
Just occasional part-timer.
Panhandlers?
Occasional part-timer occasional is an actual title.
Is that what we are?
Well, that's an actual title.
Unfortunately, it seems that's what we've become.
I used to be one.
Right. Used to be?
And now.
Used to bees don't count anymore. They just lay on the floor to you, sweep them away. That was from You Don't Bring Me Flowers Anymore, Neil Diamond. Thank you. Boy, that was a weird, obscure...
First man on the moon.
Reference. Yes, Neil Diamond was the first man on the moon with Barbara Streisand. And they sang You Don't Bring Me Flowers while they planted the flag up there.
Mm.
It was beautiful.
Up where?
A beautiful story. Up Where We Belong. It's Joe Cocker, Jennifer Warrens.
Jennifer Lawrence?
Warrens.
I didn't know she sang.
Jennifer Lawrence doesn't sing.
All right.
I'm hoping that Roger just explodes because he's trying not to laugh so much. I'm just hoping he explodes. This is we're losing an icon, folks, and it's not this show, but you never know. Sears opened its first ever store in Chicago 93 years ago. Roger, you were there.
Yes, I was.
And now the store at Six Corners is closing. Very sad. The liquidation sale at the store is set to begin April 27th. The Sears Auto Center will close mid-May. The company has declined to say how many employees work at the Six Corner store, but overall, 50,000 jobs have been shed by the Sears Corporation in 2017. They racked up more than $10.8 billion in losses, and it's hard to feel bad about that, but I kind of do. I mean, I remember as a kid going to Sears all the time. And even as an adult, Sears was the place. Now, granted, I didn't go there shopping for fashion anymore. But if I needed any sort of hand tool or stuff, I went to Sears first. Craftsman was the way to go.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a weed whacker, because once they bought up and acquired Kmart, then you could take your tools to like the Kmart and they do the repairs there. So I've always kept shopping at Sears. Mm-hmm. It was weird. It's I would look at Sears first when it came to appliances, when it came to, like I said, tools, anything like that, it was immediately Sears. If it was work clothes, I would go to Sears. Sears became synonymous with that kind of stuff. Unfortunately, and I was talking about this with a friend of mine, we kind of reap what we sow, and because internet shopping has become so widespread and so easy, it's really killing off these brick and mortar retailers. We're seeing it now with Toys R Us as well, which makes me sad too that Toys R Us is leaving. You know,
yeah.
However, before you get into this, the CEO behind the Bratz dolls, Cody, you had a full Bratz dolls collection as a child, correct?
Still do.
Yeah, the Bratz dolls, which I would never let Molly have. Because I was like, these are awful.
They're dumb.
First of all, they're called brats.
Yeah.
You don't want your kid to be a brat. Secondly, all these dolls had bad attitudes. Molly was already in the process of developing her own bad attitude. I didn't need any commercial help. So we never had brats in the house. However, the billionaire CEO, Isaac Larian, is making a bid to buy Toys R Us. He's made a formal offer of $675 million to buy the most of the Toys R Us stores in the United States and an additional $215 million for all the stores in Canada. He wants to develop them into a family destination where families will go there and stay all day. At the Toys R Us. He said, imagine a mini Disneyland in every neighborhood. So, but he also said that the liquidation of Toys R Us is going to have a long-term effect on toy businesses. The industry will truly suffer. The prospect of bringing the Toys R Us experience to a new generation, my new grandson's generation, is enough to motivate me to save Toys R Us. And he had tried to do it through crowdfunding, and that didn't work. So everybody who made, he's using his own money and investor money, but anybody who made a pledge is getting their money back. So we're losing two huge chains, and it's hard to keep track of all the chains that we've lost over the last, you know, 5-10 years. But Sears, it's going to be rough.
Well, again, it's only the last Chicago store. There are still other Sears stores.
Right, but they're reconfiguring them.
Right.
There's one near me, one in Orland. They're turning into like a movie theater. I don't know what they're doing there.
Yeah.
The one in North Riverside, I know they're keeping one floor as Sears, and the other floor is going to be like some entertainment center. So there's still Sears around, and there's still one Kmart, I think, left in Illinois from the article. But
one of the big deals is that Sears does not really have the online presence. They never embraced that.
No, they were all the catalog.
Yeah.
They were the mail order, and then they were people are going to go into Sears.
And I did go to the Sears at Gulf Mill. I used to buy my suits there because they were the only store that had my size.
Really?
Because they used to have off sizes. You know, like
for off-sized men.
For off-sized men.
Are you half ogre, half gremlin? Come in. Sears has a suit for you. Is one arm 18 inches longer than the other? Do you have a hump? Come on in. Sears, what are you, walking on a peg leg? Yeah, come on in. Sears has a suit for you. Hook hand? Yes, come on in, Captain Hook. We can fit you. What does that mean? What kind of size? What size are you? Like a 46 short and oblong?
Yes.
Okay.
But seriously, that would do it. Like you would normal men's sizes would be like, you know, a 38, a 40. They go every two sizes.
By two. Sure.
But you could buy a 39 there. They would have that size you can't get anywhere else.
Are you sure they weren't just taking a marker and changing the 8 to a 9?
If they did, it still fit. I don't care.
How is a company making suits that will sell in one place? We are the exclusive suit provider for Sears. We are the haberdasher. Of the men who need,
Well, you have the big and tall men's stores.
That's true.
The short and husky.
Yeah, but those brands are brands that are the same as brands that are sold everywhere.
But
they
there
just
are
make
some.
Different ones.
There are some sizes.
All right, listen,
you
I'm not
going to
argue
get.
With you with your
no,
weird
not,
size.
Not.
With your, I believe you got odd size clothes there. Whatever. I've seen you dress. That's fine. That's what you want to brag about. That go to Golf Mills, Sears, and buy your off size suits made with unidentifiable fabrics and pleats on the back instead of on the front of the pants. I don't. Okay. That's fine. You wear what you got to wear. I'm not. Who am I to judge? But they're so it says, and you were right, North Riverside, Niles, Chicago Ridge, Vernon Hills, Schaumburg, and Bloomingdale will still have Sears stores after Six Corners closes. Oakbrook Center closed last summer for renovation and downsizing, which is what they're doing in Orland and North Riverside.
Okay.
Yeah, they're downsizing. And then there is I think they said there was, Kmart's are closing too, but there was one or
now,
there are
Kmart
a couple.
Does have a decent online presence.
If you tell me that you buy suits at Kmart.
No, I do not.
They don't have, they
I
just
don't
have
go to
traditional
Kmart anymore,
sizes.
Even though this, sure. Yeah. Is from Kmart.
Is it? It's a nice Searsucker button down.
It's gorgeous.
It's
I have three of them, and they don't make this anymore.
Wow.
And I've tried other Searsucker shirts.
Sure.
And I don't like the way they feel.
Listen, I'm not above a bargain.
Yeah.
I was bragging one night when I was in for Nick about my $5 flannel that I got at Walmart.
Boom.
You know, like I'm not some snooty clothes horse. So I'd never heard of the weird suit sizes.
That's what they used to
Cody
have.
Wears like an 82, extremely gangly.
Yes.
It's a weird size.
Yeah.
You cut your suit at Sears, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He gets
82,
the tall
extremely
and gangly.
Gangly.
Size
yeah.
Gangly.
He goes in the gangly department. I used to, that was one of the most horrifying things of being a fat kid, is having to go into the husky department at Sears, because it said so right on your pants.
Yeah.
It said husky right on the back. There was no denying it.
But at least you're big and tall, which is what these big and tall places cater to. I'm tall,
you're
but
tall
I'm not
tall.
Big.
No, you're not big.
And I can't find anything that fits me. Everybody's like, go into a big and tall store. I'm like, well, that's great if my waist was 8 inches bigger, but I'm not big. I'm just tall.
You need to talk to Sears. Have them start carrying your weird size, too.
Yeah.
The underweight and gangly.
You know, the failure of Sears is so historically astoundingly bad since Eddie Lampert took over. It's just comically. He's the CEO.
I'm sorry, what?
Eddie Lampert, the CEO of Sears.
Yeah.
Since he became in charge, like, he's probably the worst CEO of all time. Like, he has almost single-handedly driven that company into the ground.
That's what, I mean, that was happening to Penny's for a while, too. They had a CEO who was going to do all this stuff, and Penny's was on the verge of having to shutter all their stores, and then they rebounded because they realized there's there are certain stores that you can go into and you expect to see little cool boutique-y areas. You know, you go to the higher end stores, your Nordstrom's, Macy's, Lord & Taylor, those kind of places. You go to Penny's, you want not low quality, but it doesn't have to be as fancy. You know, you could go to Penny's and now Penny's has bounced back.
It doesn't have the brand name on it.
Right.
Yeah.
It has bounced back, and I like, you know.
Well, I was just at Kohl's earlier today.
Sure.
And one of the ways that they're trying to stay relevant is that you can now return stuff that you bought on Amazon.
Yes.
Even if it's not from Kohl's.
Right. They've got the big Amazon
exactly.
center.
Exactly.
They've opened
and
one of those near my house,
line there.
Yeah.
People using that convenience of that store instead of trying to do the label and waiting
That's,
for Amazon
see,
to come by and everything.
As much as I love online shopping, the returns are always a hassle. But right. I had ordered something a couple weeks ago, and it came, and it did not fit. And one of the pros of this company was I was able to take it to a store.
Yeah.
Now, granted, the minute I walked in the store with this box, they tried to sell me something else, and I was like, no, I'm here to... And then I ended up looking around and buying something.
Well, sure. And that's what they're trying to do.
But
they're
I still returned what I had to... What yeah. I had to return. It was
yeah.
nice. 312-981-7200. Are you going to miss Sears? Are you hopeful for Toys R Us? Are there other retailers that still, after all these years, and I know we're going to get Marshall Fields. I still miss Marshall Fields. Let it go. Macy's is all right.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, you know, they decimated some of the State Street store, but that I don't think is Macy's. I think that's just a matter of not getting the customers.
And they've downsized you know? A little bit because now they're trying to sell the upper floors
and that basement area that used to be all restaurants and stuff is not really happening too much, except I think at lunch they do some things.
Right.
So 312-981-7200. We'll talk more about it on the other side. It's WGN. Toys R Us, we know, is closing, and about a billionaire... The billionaire CEO behind Bratz Dolls is making an offer to buy Toys R Us and reconfiguring it because he says the toy industry will definitely suffer. And we've heard that when there was first rumors of Toys R Us bankruptcies, that it would really, there'd be a huge trickle-down effect for the toy industry. Now, most of us, you know, have outgrown the toy industry, or every once in a while you would have to get a toy. And since Molly got older, my visits to Toys R Us have dwindled.
Sure.
And even if I have to get stuff for my nieces, occasionally I would go to Toys R Us, but I would go to Target or Walmart or wherever I was that had toys. And, you know, I didn't buy those online because I had to see them. But, you know, people are buying all their toys on Amazon and online.
And I got to admit,
for the grandkids,
I'm buying almost everything online.
Really?
I once in a while, I'll go to Target because it's one of the it's the closest store that has toys.
Okay.
Or like if I'm with them and they've been promised a certain toy for their birthday or whatever, I'll take them to Target and let them pick which one of that toy. Because there's various
Aren't
different versions.
Aren't you a nice grandpa?
Especially if they're dolls.
Yes.
You know, from a brand of dolls. So there's this one and that one and that one, all of that brand.
So which one do you want, kids?
Well, it's yeah.
No, it makes sense.
Yeah. But if it's something like they say, oh, I like, they're really into the superhero girls series now. It's the teenage version of all the superheroes and supervillains.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
Of DC
Supergirl,
or Marvel?
Huh?
DC.
Or,
oh, DC, yeah.
DC. So you have, you know, you got Supergirl, you got Batgirl, you got...
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Girl.
Wonder Girl.
Yeah.
Oh, because it's the youngest.
It's all teenage version. They're all in high school. But now you've got, like, some of the villains, the female villains in their teenage years...
Really?
...are still kind of villains, but they all go to school together.
They're mean girls.
They're mean girls.
They're mean girls. The mean girl equivalent of villains.
But, so they like collecting those, and I just recently bought a lot of books... the storybooks for them and everything, plus also now the Star Wars.
Yeah.
Rey,
the
top female character now, there's books for kids.
No, it should be. Listen, girls need role models, too, that you know, the same kind of thing boys do. This is very disturbing. I didn't know this was a case. Maybe, ladies, if you want, you can confirm this. One of the texters from the 847 said, at the same time Sears called certain boys' sizes husky, the girls' versions were known as chubby.
No.
That can't be true. Can you imagine?
Disgusting.
Your daughter? It was the 60s and the 70s.
But still.
Listen, chubby girls need love, too. Husky was bad enough.
Yeah,
but
right.
Chubby, that would explain a myriad of personality and eating disorders, if that were the case. Can you imagine taking your daughter and going, we have to go to the chubby section?
And it's not like...
Come here, chubs.
It's not like there wouldn't be any signage or anything. The labels on all the clothes would say
chubby. Chubby. Yes, chubby. Oh, I'm sorry. These got mislabeled. You need to go to the chubby section.
Oh, horrible.
Waddle over there.
I found a site on thesocietypages.org with sociological images of vintage ads for chubby things. chubby ads. There's this one from Lane Bryant.
That's a woman's.
Yeah, but still.
Well, the ad literally reads, free for chubbies. Fall and winter fashions book full of charming chubby sized clothes.
What year?
I don't know about this one, but yeah, there's one for Sears and Tracy Harper may not care if fashionable chubby sizes are hard to find, but her mother does, and so does Sears.
Wow.
These are things that I'm finding on the internet that are not okay. There's one Chubettes. Where is this from?
What, Chubettes?
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody's saying they believe it's plus sizes. That's now it's plus sizes. Yeah. I don't know. Chubettes. Somebody else texted in Chubettes.
If you're just tuning in, we're just talking about how ridiculous and inappropriate it is that in the past, Sears and other department stores actually called their plus size clothing chubby clothing.
And Cody's brand, No Chubbies. Those are the two things we're talking about right now. Sears' inappropriate branding and Cody's questionable branding choice
for his
personal brand. Somebody said they miss Goldblatt's, the one on 26th Street, especially the confection store that made chocolate-covered marshmallow and graham cracker, chocolate-covered marshmallow with graham cracker bottoms in their record department.
I was in the record department.
I don't remember. They didn't make the chocolate in the record department. They missed. They were two separate things.
Oh, and
the confection counter, and the thing. I don't remember Goldblatt's. I remember Montgomery Ward.
Mm-hmm.
They went their way. Venture, we used to go to all the time. That was gone.
Zare.
Hilo, Zare. We used to go grocery shopping at the Hilo with my grandma. Corvette. Yes, we had a Corvette's. That's where we used to get our toys.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, because the Corvettes in Chicago Heights.
They would always advertise at the holidays, big time, for the toys.
That's where I'd get the G.I. Joes at Corvettes. Yeah. And I remember when Toys R Us was Bargain Town.
Yes.
Do you remember Bargain Town?
Well, Bargain Town was predated Toys R Us.
Right. All right, I'm going to see if you remember this.
Okay.
So yesterday, I was in Oak Brook Terrace. Okay. And I was driving down Route 83, and a song came into my head about a retailer that used to be in Oak Brook Terrace, Illinois. And they ended their commercial with OIS because
it rhymes with toys.
Right. Dispenser's Castle of Toys.
Yes.
Oak Brook Terrace, mm-hmm. Illinois. And how long has Dispenser's Castle of Toys been going? Forever.
Yeah.
But that jingle is still in my head, and I never...
It's online. I know this because on another show we've talked about...
Oh, yeah?
Stores that are gone.
Castle Left Home.
Yes, and I bet you if he's...
Illinois, he's not.
If Cody is quick, he can find it. Here's another one, and I don't...
Plus-size pantyhose used to be called Ample.
Ample?
Ample. Oh, we do. We have a break. I say that because the last couple hours, because we weren't supposed to be on until 5.
There wasn't anything.
There were no commercials, so we just talked right up to the thing. All right, we got to do this. Last year, I was, once again, the host for the big black tie induction gala for the Irish American Hall of Fame, which happens at the Irish American Heritage Center on Knox. You know all about the Irish American Heritage Center. We've had people on here all the time. And Mike Shevlin is with us. He is one of the committee members. He's a board member of the Heritage Center, one of the committee members for the Irish American Hall of Fame. And it's always an exciting event. How many years has the Hall of Fame been going?
Well, we're celebrating our 8th year this year. We started in 2010 with some fact-finding and getting started with the event. Our first event was in 2011, and here we are. You know, it's our 8th year this year.
That's terrific. And what was the impetus? I mean, the Heritage Center's been going for a long time, and it does wonderful stuff. What was the impetus to get the Hall of Fame, to start the Hall of Fame?
Well, it's a couple of things. First of all, it was a bit of a surprise that no one had done this before.
I will agree with you on that.
So the Irish American Heritage Center has been in existence for nearly 40 years now, when in 2010 we said, well, no one is doing this. And it's the story of the Irish here in America is so profound and so strong that we thought that it was maybe this is what we should be doing with ourselves. And that's what we did. And our first inaugural class was in 2011, and we had all kinds of wonderful inductees, and it was a very successful event. And we've just kind of added to it over the last several years.
So who was in that first class? Who were some of the inductees in the first group?
Well, there's a lot of names that you might know or
sure.
may not know, but President John F. Kennedy was one of them.
Most people will know that. I'll go with we know that name.
Henry Ford, the inventor, of
sure.
course. And then Jack Dempsey, the boxer, was another
one
that
nice.
Was big. And, of course, Mayor Richard J. Daley, the
okay.
first Richard Daley of our Chicago mayors. And, of course, Sister Rosemary Connolly was another one that was in that first class. So there was Maureen O'Hara, the actress,
okay.
Eugene O'Neill, and, of course, Chief Francis O'Neill. We're all part of that first class.
That's pretty – it's a pretty strong group, and you think to yourself, well – at some point, there can't be this many great Irishmen and women around, but there are. Every year, and I've said this for the years that I've been involved, every year the classes seem to get more and more distinguished. And you go, wow, this is, I thought last year was good. These people are just as deserving. What goes into someone being nominated and finally being elected into the Hall of Fame?
Well, first of all, it's an open nomination. So, you know, you go to www.iahof.org. And you can nominate. We open nominations for a certain amount of time, usually it's in the July time period, and you have a couple of months where you can nominate whoever you want.
Okay.
And then we have a screening committee made up of not really our committee, but mainly like people, esteemed members of the Irish American community here in Chicago and outside of Chicago.
That's an important point because it's not just local
right.
people making this
these
decision.
These are Irish studies professors. They might be radio or TV personalities. They might be authors that have written on Irish history, but also it's people that kind of know the history of the Irish here in America, and they can say, well, you know, maybe this person belongs, this person doesn't belong,
right.
and who are we to say that? As a committee, we are not.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's nice that part is out of the committee's hands,
yeah,
because on paper, most people look like they should. Like
right.
they should be inducted.
Yeah, well, early on, our decision was to say, you know, we don't want any part of this. You know,
right.
like, well, we will be the facilitator for mm-hmm. all of the best in Irish America to be, nominated and screened down to where we have a voting committee that's even more esteemed,
yes.
I suppose you could say, than the screening committee. But these are people that take it very seriously, and they look at every biography, and they look at it and say, who are the people that truly deserve to be here? And, you know, as a committee member since the beginning, as an Irish American myself, and as a longtime volunteer at the Irish American Hall of Fame, or Irish American Heritage Center.
Your dad is one of the people who built the center.
He's
correct?
One of many.
One of many, yes.
With my parents. They were both there in the beginning. And it's very important for us that this place be representative of what Irish America certainly should be.
Yeah.
And, it shouldn't be us voting on this kind of stuff. And what's cool about it is over the years is we've learned that wow, every year is an education.
Yes.
We learn about all these new people that that we never would have thought of
right.
because of the outreach that we've made. And every year it's a different story. And so we've found that over the years that, with the attendees, with the inductees, mm-hmm. the inductees meeting different families and meeting different inductees, that's the story of what we do every year.
Right.
These people meeting each other, families getting together, but they all have a very similar story about the Irish in America, how their families came over, and what their families have done to build themselves up here in the U.S.
And it's not always first generation or people who came themselves. It could be grandparents came to this country, and then. But it's the Irish heritage has run throughout this person's life, and they've learned about it because of their roots
right.
back in Ireland.
It's so true. And, you know, we have rules, of course. You know, you can't just nominate anybody. And
sure.
But, of course, the person that is nominated has to have Irish roots, but be American citizen.
Yeah.
Because for us, we're telling the story and preserving the story of what the Irish in America has done. You know, I look here outside on beautiful Michigan Avenue, and what we've done, what the Irish have done in just this city alone.
Oh, yeah.
Everything from the building all over the country, from the railroads and the canals and what Chicago, in particular, the Chicago Irish did with politicians
mm-hmm.
and building the city as it was. It's a story that needs to be told, and we're really happy to be able to tell it every year.
Now, we mentioned John F. Kennedy and Richard J. Daley, but you had mentioned that there were, you know, sometimes it's a history lesson. We learn about Irish Americans that we might not know about. give me a couple of examples of inductees over the years that have surprised you, that you didn't, you may have heard their name, maybe you didn't hear their name, but they, it really stuck out that you went, oh, wow, this is definitely a deserving inductee that if we didn't have this widespread nominating committee, I wouldn't have been aware of.
Well, there's been several of those over the years.
Yeah, and
of
I'm
course,
not, but, I, but you're not endorsing your favorite, I'm just saying.
But there's a few that come to mind, and it happens every single year. Right. You know, last year we inducted the astronauts, Scott and Mark Kelly.
Right.
You know, and oftentimes when some of these inductees, they're part of the fabric of the American society, they're American heroes. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily think of their Irish side of it.
And, right, exactly.
And what we try to do every year, they were inducted in the science category last year, along with a lot of astronauts, surprisingly, in the science category.
Yeah, there have been a lot of Irish astronauts.
But all of them come
aviators.
Back. Every story comes back to, you know what? They've never really thought about the fact that their Irish upbringing and their family before them, what the work ethic and all that was instilled in them, help them to get where they were. And they're a classic example, and they were part of our induction ceremony last year. Mm-hmm. And every year there's somebody like that. You know, we inducted last year Maureen Connolly.
Right, Little Mo.
Little Mo. And it had to be one of the most emotional and just so tangible within the crowd,
yeah,
about how she touched and how her family was touched by winning this award.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of also what we enjoy, like allowing these families to be awarded for something that they're not used to being, yeah, I guess, credited for.
Right. They're, like Maureen Connolly, for example, she had been heralded in the world of sports and all of that, but this was paying homage to her roots. You know, her Irish roots, and that's something, as you mentioned, something her family loved, but it really moved them that this was what we were talking about her mother for, not her prowess on the court.
Right, yeah. And that was, you know, if we're going to go there, I mean, I think the big story from last year was the fact that we actually inducted Bill Murray,
yes,
into the Irish American Hall of Fame, and there was a couple things that came out of that I thought were just really cool, you know, like for us as a committee, for us as the Irish American Hall of Fame and the Heritage Center, for all of us involved in it, wow, Bill Murray is coming to our
right.
place. But he spent the whole evening wowed by the whole event.
Yes.
And he was moved and, you know, tears among the family.
He was crying when Lawrence McCaffrey, who was also inducted last year, was giving his speech. Lawrence McCaffrey, if you don't know, is a professor emeritus of history at Loyola. And while he was speaking, I have a beautiful vantage point to watch the,
right.
the proceedings.
Brian is our MC for the evening,
and,
for those that do not know.
And it was to watch Bill Murray crying during that and paying rapt attention to the every nominee, every inductee, rather, has a beautiful video made to honor them and to tell their story to the crowd. And, boy, he couldn't have paid more attention to all of that.
And he was one of those that told us afterwards that he was blown away by the presentation.
Yeah.
He was blown away by the humanity of everybody that was inducted. Mm-hmm. Not, and he was also thrilled that it wasn't just about him.
Right. Yeah.
And
he was one of
so
seven.
Much. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what we try to do every year. It's not about one person. It's not about one group. It's we try to honor a number of people throughout the evening.
And the people are inducted into a number of categories: arts and humanities. We mentioned science already. Business and industry, public service, sports, religion, and education. We will talk about this year's class because it is another phenomenal class. But we want people to come to this this Black Tie Gala. You get to get all dressed up. You get to hobnob with top-notch Irish men and women. And you get to see me in a tux. I think those are all fine, fine selling points. The nominee, the inductees, that's really the selling point. How do people get tickets?
Well, the best way to get tickets right now is to go to our website at www.iahof.org.
Okay.
And you can purchase tickets individually or by tables. And there's still tickets available as we speak. And it's going to be a wonderful evening.
And it's April 28th. I should mention that. Saturday, April 28th. There's a wonderful cocktail reception before the ceremony.
Correct.
And then you get dinner and you get to watch these inductees, learn their stories, hear the hear the acceptance, whether it's family accepting. Some people, as we'll mention, create a video acceptance. There's a lot of different ways that the inductees are there other than in person. So we'll talk all about the new class of inductees at the Irish American Hall of Fame. Again, it's IAHOF.org. You can get your tickets now. Get yourself all gussied up. Ladies, put on a gown. Guys, put on a tux. Come on out. It is a wonderful, wonderful evening celebrating Irish heritage and some of the best examples of that heritage that you will ever find. More with Mike Shevlin from the Irish American Hall of Fame. On the other side, it's WGN. We are talking about the Irish American Hall of Fame. The big black tie induction gala for the 2018 class is on April 28th, Saturday night, April 28th. That is at the Irish American Heritage Center on Knox. You can go to IAHOF.org to get your tickets for the event. This was a little highlight from last year.
I want to thank Brian Miller for going on.
I play that all the time just because I can't believe Bill Murray actually said my name. So Bill Murray was last year, but, and it's always funny because the years that I've been involved with the Hall, Mike, every year we say, wow, how are we going to top last year's class? Because every year, as I mentioned earlier, every year the classes get more and more impressive. And this year is no exception. Who are some of the inductees this year to the Hall of Fame? There we go. Now you're in.
Well, I think first and foremost, we are inducting this year Vice President Joe Biden into the Irish American Hall of Fame.
Not too shabby.
So he'll join a long group of statesmen that have before him, including the Kennedys.
You say, President Robert. Kennedy was in there. Robert
right.
Kennedy is
and,
in there.
And Daniel Moynihan and Ronald Reagan. And
Both mayors daily.
And there's more to that as well, because every year there's somebody, right? But Joe Biden will be inducted this year.
Very
also,
nice.
Author, historian, mainly presidential historian, I think, and also a frequent guest on Meet the Press and other TV shows on Sunday mornings. It's Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Very nice.
Will be part of the 2018 class. Philanthropist and businessman Charles Feeney, Chuck Feeney. Chuck Feeney, he was the founder, one of the co-founders of Duty Free Shops. And he earned all kinds of money over all so many years, and then he gave it all away.
That's an amazing story.
It really is, and we hope he may or may not be able to join us. He's advanced in years, but we are going to have family support on that evening, and it's going to be a wonderful thing. In addition, Charles Comiskey.
Yes, speaking of the White Sox, and this, I must say, I was very bolstered by the fact that most of the people on the Hall of Fame committee are White Sox
fans.
Yeah,
we're all White Sox fans.
So this is, and we're not just smooching butt here, but yes, Charles Comiskey is being inducted this year.
The old Roman.
Yes.
Which sounds nothing Irish at all.
But of course,
myself, my father and my grandfather were White Sox fans, and it all goes back to the fact, back in the day, South Side, Bridgeport, all that, Irish immigrants were White Sox fans because of Charles Comiskey.
Right.
So it continues to this day, almost for me at least, almost 100 years later. So it's we're excited about
that.
Well,
and I know the Comiskeys are coming. I have been lobbying to get Southpaw there.
Well,
I think we need Southpaw and we need the inflatable ambassadors to come and do a big sausage race down the hall.
If they keep raining out,
yes,
we might have the whole team. We might be able to invite the starting lineup.
Yeah, get Renteria over there with all the boys because, will you agree? April baseball is stupid.
Yeah.
April baseball is ridiculous. So Charles Comiskey's coming in.
We also have Blessed, and I say that with the utmost respect, Blessed Solanus Casey.
Explain for those that don't understand the determination.
So Solanus Casey, Father Solanus Casey, has been beatified in the Catholic Church. He's just one step away from
being a saint.
A saint.
Yeah.
And, all the good works he's done in the Detroit, Michigan area and throughout the country, and we're finally honoring him with this award, probably too late. But it's a wonderful thing.
Since you brought that up, going back to the nominating process, I know there are people who've nominated, been nominated a number of times, and then it comes to the voting. In your estimation of Blessed Solanus Casey, it takes too long. That's got to be frustrating sometimes when you look at the nominees and you go, well, they're all qualified, and then you put it out to the voting, the voting body, and these people don't make it.
None of these are our choice as a committee. We put this out to a vote from the screening committee down to the voting body, and it's their job to, based on a number of specific categories on how they feel about these people. Yeah. And, you know, Charles Comiskey was, for instance, was nominated the first year, 8 years ago. It's taken him this long to get here.
So it's like the real Hall of Fame.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like the baseball Hall of Fame.
But you're right.
But there's just so many people, and every year there's an influx of new people that kind of changes the game a little bit. And when you throw those to the voting body that actually votes on these people, sometimes those scores fluctuate. But Solanas Casey
is finally in.
For sure deserving.
That's terrific. Who's our education inductee this year?
We're excited this year to induct Sister Ann Ida Gannon. She's part of the BVM sisterhood, and she's going to be inducted this year. And, you know, the BVMs, we've had a number of them over the course of the years.
Yeah.
And, very happy to welcome her into the flock.
Are you saying
so
that perhaps the BVM is skewing the voting somehow, that they're lobbying? Could there be some lobbying involved?
Well, you know what? I'm not going to say they're not deserving. That's for sure.
No, I'm not saying they're not deserving either. They're very deserving. Real quickly, we've got our science inductee.
Yeah, the science nominee is John Philip Holland, who is the inventor of the submarine. So
you spoke of learning. So I learned this year.
So it's interesting. We've had a couple of these over the years where these people that you don't necessarily know, they're Irish. And John Philip Holland, of course, he worked with the U.S. Navy, but he also worked with the IRA back in the day. And he had this Fenian submarine that he invented specifically to circumvent the English the cause back in the day. And he ended up selling that same protege, I suppose, to the Japanese, and he was, you know, but we're going to have a representative from the United States Navy to talk about submarines and about how John Philip Holland was one of those that influenced everything in modern warfare that we see today.
And, of course, there's always a hometown hero. This year's hometown hero, Mark Doyle.
Yeah, Mark Doyle, he's the founder of Rags of Honor. So for those that don't know Mark Doyle, he's been all over. I think I've seen him on WGN TV.
Yeah.
I know he's been on WGN Radio. Mark is a veteran who has created a screen printing shop that only employs veterans and homeless veterans in particular, and those that are unemployed. And it's a great story. He's a good friend of Joe Biden, for one. He's done a lot of work here in the city of Chicago and beyond, and we're very happy. Our hometown hero was one of those opportunities to honor people that normally wouldn't fit into the realm of the John F. Kennedys of the world, you know, and they do just as much on a
grassroots level.
Exactly.
A local grassroots level. So we congratulate Mark Doyle and all the inductees. If you want to be part of this wonderful event, it's happening at the Irish American Heritage Center on Saturday, April 28th. What time does the whole thing start?
So cocktails at 6:30, dinner and program 7:30.
Perfect. So, and it's and you get to the inductees all have these wonderful, beautiful banners created for them by Laura Coyle, the designer who works with the center.
She's fantastic.
And they are it's a wonderful thing to see, and the videos that are created for each inductee, it's a wonderful night, and not just because I'm part of it, it just is. If you have any thought or any pride in your Irish heritage, you need to get there. You can go to IAHOF.org. You can still buy tickets. You can get single tickets. You can buy tickets as a table. But be sure to put on your Sunday best and come out on a Saturday night, and you will not be disappointed. Right? Is that a good pitch?
Absolutely.
Mike, you look like,
thank you, Brian.
You got anything more to say? Mike Shevlett is part of the Hall of Fame committee and a board member at the Irish American Heritage Center. Thank you very much for coming in.
I will see you soon.
All right, let's do this quickly. Then it's news time on WGN. Got the whole show today, but then we will not be here next week. And you may say to yourself, well, why not? I'm going to be in New Orleans, and Cody is taking the weekend off because I'm not here and he's antisocial. With anybody except me.
It's pretty much accurate.
That's very accurate. So we will not be here next week. But I think Amy Guth is sitting in for us next week from 5 to 7. Yeah, Amy Guth, who just had a birthday. So be nice to Amy when she's here. She's a wonderful, wonderful talent.
We both just had birthdays as well.
We did both have birthdays. Did you do anything exciting?
My wife held me a surprise party.
Really?
For the first time.
I did not
time.
Get an invite.
I've never had it. You know, I don't know why that was.
I know why, and I completely understand. Was it fun?
It was incredible.
And were you surprised?
Oh, it was so good. It was so well executed.
Was there cake and ice cream?
there was, well, there were going to be cupcakes, but then my sister forgot them at a restaurant or something. I don't know. They didn't end up appearing.
Cupcakes.
It's fine. There was still plenty of food and snacks and drinks. And
very nice.
Mostly drinks.
Sure.
Lots
of
drinks.
That's what a party should be.
And you had a...
I did nothing. I had I actually had a meeting for the Irish American Hall of Fame that night. So I saw my wife for about 5 minutes between, because she had worked late and I was leaving for the meeting. She came in. She said, oh, happy birthday. And gave me a wonderful new Bowron, so custom made just for me.
Wow.
It's a beautiful instrument, and I was very excited about that. And I've got some text, you know, my whole family texted me, and Molly called and texted. And but yeah, so my birthday, I'll tell you, I was on spring break from school, so I had a couple Bloody Marys and learned how to use Photoshop. That was how I spent my birthday, which I thought was productive. I treated myself to a drink. And I learned something. So I felt normally I hate my birthday, but this year was productive. I didn't master something, but I learned something. So that was a lot of fun. And then the day after my birthday, on your birthday, we had Chinese food to celebrate my birthday.
Perfect.
That was how it was. It was very, very nice. Speaking of celebrating, which we were, but a loose tie-in. Don't compliment this segue because it was awful. I just want to remind everybody that I'm going to England in October. Not by myself. I'm not becoming an expat. I might, though. Cody, do me a favor. Research morning zoos in England. Perhaps you and I could start a morning zoo over there.
Okay.
On the BBC. We could do accents, can't we?
We talked to an Irish radio station.
We did.
Remember when
yes.
Obama won
yep.
the election?
Right.
We were doing the overnights,
yep.
and it was like 3 a.m. U.S. time, but it was the morning in Ireland, and we connected with an actual radio station's ISDN, and we were both on. We simulcast.
Yes, simulblasted across the sea.
That was crazy.
I think we should look into that again, but that's neither here nor there. The reason I'm going to England, but I like that, so keep that in mind. Let's do that, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to give away our plans.
Sure.
I don't want management to know that we're secretly shopping ourselves to overseas radio stations.
Good thing we're not talking about it on the radio right
that
now.
That would be awful.
Yeah.
Did I mention that, you know, I turned this offer down, but I got one to do afternoon drive in Pyongyang.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I turned it down.
Yeah.
The street names would be too difficult for me. I couldn't, you know. I would have no idea how to pronounce the street names. I could barely pronounce Pyongyang,
yeah.
Which I don't think I did.
You definitely did not.
I did not. Anyway, from October 11th to the 20th, I am going to England. My beautiful wife is coming along, and you can come too. See, that's the beauty of it. Because, you know, Steve Bertrand Travel does these wonderful tours, and I am leading an England's Treasures tour. It is going to be a lot of fun. We are going to, you get round-trip airfare from Chicago on American Airlines. We get 4-star accommodations every night. We get breakfast daily, including the day we arrive. There's going to be all sorts of wonderful tours. We're going to see a full-day London City tour, the Victoria and Albert Museum, Stonehenge, Westminster Abbey, the Tower of London, a self-guided tour of the Bombay Sapphire Distillery. So you can carry me out in a box after I've drunk gin all day. We're going to see going to the Cotswolds and wandering around for a day. That'll be a lot of fun. 24-hour London Underground Pass. There'll be all sorts of wonderful, wonderful things. It's a 10-day tour from October 11th to the 20th, and I hope you can join us. All you need to do is contact Steve at steve@stevebertrandtravel.com or call 847-606-6065. That's 847-606-6065, and you can join me and my wife in England. That will be a lot of fun. I will not be doing the show that day, Cody. So whatever Sunday falls in there, I will not be doing the show.
Good to know.
But I will post something. I'll be posting things.
On Facebook.
On sure Facebook. That's a Brian Noonan show on Facebook. All right, now, I enthralled Pam Jones with this tease, and I may have disgusted you with the cheese, but do you read in the bathroom? I read in the bathroom all the time. I've read in the bathroom since I was a young boy. And I, you know, whether it's a book, magazines, I favor magazines in the bathroom because you can read a lot of short articles or even the long ones. I can put a little piece of tissue in there and mark my spot for my next visit to the bathroom because we all visit the bathroom more than once a day. That's really my bathroom habits are none of your concern. But we read in the bathroom. Some people now take their phones in there, which I did not do for every once in a while. Once in a great while, I will take my phone into the bathroom with me. But normally it's magazines or the occasional book. And a lot of people will say, oh, that's gross, or I'd never do that, or it's bad for your health, blah, 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 blah. Found an article in Time magazine. I actually found it online, time.com, but in defense of using your phone on the toilet. And I thought to myself, this is right up my alley. But it's not just about using your phone on the toilet. It's about reading in general. Because there have been a lot of different studies and a lot of different theories. And some people say that it is not good. Some psychoanalysts have argued that it is a sign of abnormality to read in the bathroom. Do you read in the bathroom?
I do stuff on my phone usually.
Okay, in the bathroom. Do you consider yourself abnormal?
Definitely.
All right, then maybe you're right. Medical authorities say that it exposes us to gastrointestinal problems and fearsome germs. Some critics also contend that it signifies a mind or a culture out of balance that we're reading in the bathroom. Should people who read in the bathroom yield to the call of decency and hygiene and give up their troublesome habit? Or should they read without shame? I say read without shame, and I'm backed up by many people. So, according to this piece in Time, the psychoanalysts, two of whom have explored why people might be driven to read in the bathroom. The first was Otto Fenichel, who determined in 1937, Cody, that reading in the water closet is a passion of people with early childhood fixations. Wow, people put a lot of thought. Again, we have to get some of this crazy study money. They say that reading is an act of incorporation. So toilet reading is, quote, an attempt to preserve the equilibrium of the ego. Part of one's bodily substance is being lost, so fresh matter should be put in. Which is insane. I just, you know why I like to read in the bathroom? Because it's one of the very few places that nobody bothers me. And I think that can be said for all of us who read in the bathroom. It is peace and quiet. Because nobody wants to wander in while you're doing your business. And so you're sitting there and you can, you know, if you've always wanted to read, finish that article, whatever. James Strachey, Sigmund Freud's English translator, argued in 1930 that light reading of the sort that bathroom readers prefer is essentially infantile. Wow, casting many aspersions. The blissful absorption, the smooth, uninterrupted enjoyment that characterized the mental states of a novel reader, that their nourishment is liquid and they're sucking it in. Well, you know, Freud had a lot of crazy theories. So it's, it doesn't surprise me that the theory of about reading. All right, what about the medical implications? Because, you know, you get piles. I don't know what. No, you get piles from sitting on cement. That's what they say. Piles. Look it up. I'm not going to explain it to you. It's been argued that toilet reading produces hemorrhoids by increasing the time spent sitting and straining. There's also worries about different germs. Well, there have been studies done on this, and there's no correlation between reading on the toilet and getting hemorrhoids. People get hemorrhoids. Doesn't mean that they're just reading on because they're reading on the toilet. And it also, there's worry that your smartphone is going to have a lot of germs, correct? No. First of all, you might get some on your fingers and some on your stuff. But they argue that the bacteria that would be on your phone that was on your fingers is bacteria that's already on your body anyway. So that's a moot point. That bacteria is not going to kill you. And there have been studies done that show that the bathroom is not the most disgusting germ-infested place in your house. It is where, Cody?
The kitchen?
The kitchen is correct. Oh, if I had a prize, I would keep it for myself just to teach you a lesson. Yes, the kitchen is supposed to be the dirtiest place. From the sponge, like your kitchen cloth or sponge, which mm-hmm. is the grossest, to oven handles, to the countertops, all of that is more germ-infested than what's in your bathroom. So, the gist of this story, the takeaway from all of this, is if somebody's giving you a hard time for reading in the bathroom, poo-poo them. Ha-ha! No pun intended. Pun increasingly intended. Exceptionally intended. Tell them, listen, I can read in the bathroom whenever I want. I have a stack of magazines in my bathroom. A stack. And I thumb through them whenever I'm in there. You know, again, gives me, it's my respite. I don't have a man cave. I don't have a fortress of solitude. I have a throne of solitude. I turn on the vent fan so it sounds like I'm taking care of serious business, even if I'm not, and then I just thumb through a magazine and read it. That is how it works. A lot of people read their devotions in the bathroom. I'm not sure what that means. It just means I don't want to read the article after you. Oh, no, you read your own thing. That's fine. I don't blame a texter who doesn't want to read the article. Go on your phone. Go on your own phone. Read it. Time.com. So, yes, you should be able to read in the bathroom. All right. We've been hearing a lot about Facebook. Have you deleted Facebook yet, Cody? Have you hashtag deleted Facebook?
I did a pretty thorough purge of apps. So, connected apps that swap data with Facebook. I no longer use the sign in with Facebook option with nearly anything I do. I've got it linked to maybe YouTube and three or four other apps that I use constantly that I kind of need.
Right.
But other than that, I purged all that. I changed a lot of my privacy settings. I removed a lot of their ad targeting capabilities. Perfect. It took me at least an hour.
Well, we are going to go through some more things that you might want to delete from your Facebook page if you are concerned about the privacy breach. Cody, as a social media maven, will help us out. I've got that. We'll talk about that after we hear this on WGN. I'll be talking to Lou Manfredini next Saturday morning at 9:20. Why? Why not? I'll be talking to him from New Orleans. Where I'll be for Crawfest, preparing to eat copious amounts of mud bugs. You ever had a crawfish, Cody?
That's a good question. I don't know.
They look like lobsters, only they're about this long. How long is that? A couple inches?
Couple inches. Few inches.
Yeah. So you,
three inches.
You twist the body, you pull it apart, then you suck the juice out of the head. That's the part that skeeves some people out.
Yeah.
You just suck the head, and then you take the tail, and it's like a tiny lobster tail, and you just pull the meat right out.
Apologies to all the vegan listeners out there.
Well, listen, no, I don't apologize for my love of mud bugs. I don't judge them on their veganness.
That's fair.
So,
how many do you have to eat before you feel full?
2006, because I had 2005 and I was still a bit peckish, so I had one more and that satiated me.
Okay,
I used peckish and satiated in one sentence.
I didn't know you could count that high.
2006?
Yeah.
Well, listen,
it was a good year.
I didn't count. I used some of what I learned in second grade and first grade, and I would count the shells. I threw the shells and I made an array.
Mm.
So I was able to use I couldn't count in my head because I was busy sucking the head and then chewing out the tail.
When you threw out the shells.
Which are not euphemisms for what I usually do when I'm left to my own devices.
When you were throwing out the shells, was it like the old Chances Are restaurant here where you threw the peanut shells on the floor?
Exactly. Well, it's it's the dirt or the grass.
That's right.
Just throw them. No, I try not to throw my. I can only imagine because I'll take a picture when I'm down there and put it on the amount of crawfish that are being boiled at this thing is insane.
Barrels
you would
full.
Think, and the amount that are of crawfish that are being boiled all over the country. This time of year, you would think there would not be a crawfish left in existence, and yet you would be wrong. But it is a season, and so this is crawfish season, it's fine. And they do, you boil it up with some potatoes and like corn on the cob, and then normally they go good with about a keg and a half of beer and three rolls of paper towel because it's messy. That's why Debbie doesn't like it. It's too messy. She's a mess averse when it comes to eating. Took her a long time to like eat ribs with me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she doesn't like she's dainty. And so she doesn't like to be. Me, I don't care. I'll eat out of a trough. It doesn't matter to me. I got to, if I got to put strap on the feed bag, I'm going to town. But she's got more couth. She's a little more refined.
Refined, classy.
Yeah, she's classified. I got her in the classifieds. It was, a mail order thing, but I don't like to talk about that. It's, it's really none of your business how
past.
Much it cost.
Yeah.
It was shipping was a bear, though. I was trying to get a wife where they had the free shipping deal.
Right.
But they didn't do that.
Oh, it didn't qualify.
Well, no, I didn't spend enough.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay, yeah.
Well, that sounds worse than it. Now not only did I make my wife a mail order bride, but a cut rate mail order bride. That I didn't even spend top tier mail order bride pricing
was
to get free shipping.
It was the weekly special.
Sure, it was clearance.
Your clearance.
Clearance. I never shop full price. She knows that. She respects that about me, that I don't pay full price. I'm constantly looking for a deal, even when it came to a life mate. So yeah, that's. But she'll eat some. She doesn't. She. The nice thing is, I'll get. We'll get. She'll get her big basket of crawfish, mm-hmm. and then I'll be able to eat hers, so I won't look like a pig. Even though I am, I'll only go up to the line once. All right, we've got to do this, and then after the news, Michael Osaki will join us. He's from BaseballInTheAttic.com. Do you have some memorabilia that you need to know if it's worth anything? Well, give us a call 312-981-7200. We'll do that after the news, which comes after this. But it's Michael Osaki. He is the creator of BaseballInTheAttic.com. He is a licensed sports memorabilia appraiser, certified sports memorabilia appraiser. He's a writer. He's done all sorts of things. You've heard of it. He's a favorite here on this program. We're always happy to have him back. 312-981-7200. If you have a piece of sports memorabilia and you want Michael to give you an idea of whether, hey, you're sitting on a treasure, or, hey, it's a nice memory, and that's pretty much it. 312-981-7200. Good to have you back, Michael. Always good to see you.
Brian, it's great to be here. Great to see you. As I'm looking outside of Michigan Avenue, it's kind of bittersweet because we've had some great memories here, but I know in a couple months you guys are moving.
Yeah. Next time you're on, we'll be at the in the new digs if they give me a key. I haven't. I hear it's very nice. We're going to be right across the river at and up on what floor is it? The 97th floor? The 4th floor? What is it?
No. I believe it's the 17th floor.
17th
yeah.
floor.
17th or 18th, yeah.
And we'll look over the lake and Navy Pier. It'll be beautiful.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Or 303 East Wacker.
Is it 303?
Yep.
All right. I thought it was 333.
No.
303?
303.
See, they told me the wrong address. This may be our last time together, Michael.
On purpose.
definitely on purpose. All right. So, let me ask, because I've made this, and then we're gonna get quick to the calls, because their calls always come in fast and furious when you're here. You've been following baseball your whole life. You April baseball. Do we need it? Does the season need to be this long?
No. Baseball is such a long season, and April, so many games get canceled or delayed because of rain and snow across the entire country.
Yes.
It's not just here in Chicago.
No.
So it probably doesn't make sense. It should go.
All right, good. That's what I was thinking too. Especially, it's crazy. I want to see. It's got to be. It's frustrating for fans, but it's got to be more frustrating for the players and the managers, because it throws everybody operates on such a tight schedule. Whether it's their sleep schedule, their practice schedule, it's all very regimented. And then you throw in these. The Sox went up to Minnesota and sat for 3 days. That's not good for anybody.
No, and I also remember a couple of years ago I was talking to a former chiropractor of the Cubs, and he was telling me the Cubs players hate April because the risk of injury.
Yes.
So it's just bad all over.
Well, and Joe Maddon came out, was it yesterday or the day before after the game, and he was like, listen, I see no wisdom in playing a game in conditions like this.
Yeah.
It's just nuts. All right. So quick background. Tell people you've been collecting cards since you were a kid. How did you make the transition into not only the website but also becoming a certified appraiser?
Yeah, I've been since 1997, I've been in this business collecting cards. The past 6 or 7 years, it's kind of morphed into what I do, a lot of writing for Parade Magazine and some other national publications. I travel the country. I'm on the road about 100 days or so a year. I do presentations, programming. I look at different collections from both people like you and I, but then I also work with former baseball players and their families to assess their collections. So let's say when XYZ player from the New York Yankees, for example, passes away, and he won a lot of World Series rings in the 1950s, the family wants to know, for estate planning, how much is this stuff worth?
Yeah.
So I'll come in and I'll give them a written appraisal.
And is that based on how other World Series rings from that era have sold? How do you make a determination? I mean, you could obviously look at just the jewels and say, well, there's this many diamonds, which would be worth this, but is it... You don't break the ring apart. You want the ring as its own entity, correct?
Yeah. Now, part of the value when it comes to a ring is the intrinsic value, which would be just the gold. But obviously, being a ring from a World Series for the Yankees, to your question, yes, comparable sales matter a lot. And then also overall demand in the entire marketplace for rings.
Okay. And if it's a marquee player, that demand is going to be higher.
Great point.
If it's a manager or somebody on the coaching staff, which is an important job, and they get rings as they should, maybe not as much demand for the third base coach's ring.
Agree completely. Usually there are three different types of rings if we're talking about baseball. You have the player ring, like Anthony Rizzo got. You have the ownership ring, so Tom Ricketts, he'll get one.
A different kind.
Different kind of ring. And then the coaches. So Joe Maddon, the third base coach, first base coach, will get a different ring. But by far, always, the most valuable is the player ring. And then, of course, if you have the MVP of the World Series or a Hall of Famer of that.
Who's been have you come across, and you don't have to name names, I guess, because that would be, have you come across an estate of a player that you thought going in, oh, well, this is going to be, they're going to have some really cool stuff, and either they exceeded your expectations or they fell short and you went, wow, I'm surprised that so-and-so didn't have something more?
Yeah, I recently did an appraisal of a guy who played for the Boston Red Sox, and the family called me in. And the collection was quite substantial. I went in thinking it would just be some rings and trophies and some autographs, but it was more encompassing. It was that, but also paintings and unique autographs from former presidents. The list went on and on.
Is it still now? When we first started talking, there was a big issue with forgeries and people who bought something and they thought, oh, I've got Mickey Mantle's autograph, for example. And after it was appraised by you or by other appraisers, it wasn't Mickey Mantle's autograph. Is that still a big problem in the memorabilia world?
Yes, always. Unfortunately, there's some bad apples out there that make their living forging autographs and selling them to unsuspecting people who think that they are original and genuine, but they're not.
Okay.
And the Mickey Mantle, the Ted Williams, the Babe Ruth, these are the superstars, and of course that's big money, and so the forgers are going to forge their autographs as opposed to the John Does.
And what about these card signing events? Is that harming the market, or just harming the market for those particular players who are making, you know, they're making the money for themselves while they can, but all these things that are being autographed by, you know, like Pete Rose is now doing shows everywhere. So has a Pete Rose autograph diminished in value? If 10 years ago you had a Pete Rose autograph and you were like, wow, this might have been worth X, but now he's out signing everything, has it dropped?
Let's talk about Pete Rose. I think he just had his birthday the other day. I think he's 77, perhaps. But anyway, so yes, his full-time job, basically, he's out in the Caesars Palace Forum Shops in Las Vegas. 6 days a week, he's signing his autograph, okay?
Right.
So you can go out there and pay about $100 to shake his hand, take a picture, and get an autographed baseball, okay? Alternatively, if you did not want to do that, but you still wanted his autograph, you could go to eBay and buy a genuine, real signed Pete Rose baseball for about $40.
Okay.
So obviously you're paying a premium to go out there, shake his hand,
meet him,
take a picture. But there really is so much supply in the marketplace. There's not much demand anymore for that for him.
So is for the players, it's a good deal because they're making their money. But for collectors, all these signings just diminish what you might have.
Well, Pete Rose is a unique example, but there are some people, collectors, that will buy autographs for investment purposes, which I never advise. You know, buy something because you like it, you like the player. But guys like Hank Aaron and Willie Mays, they need to do the autograph circuit because don't forget they didn't
make the money that modern day players are making.
I mean, most of these guys, like Eddie Matthews, he worked like an autograph automobile company during the off season. A lot of these guys had to. So, you know, Hank Aaron and Willie Mays can make six figures a year today.
Yeah, I don't begrudge those guys going out and making that money. They deserve it.
Right.
They're the ones who put in the effort and made, you know.
But one thing I will say, when it comes to modern day athletes, they have their agents. And I believe a lot of the times the agent doesn't tell the athlete exactly what's going on. And so sometimes the deals happen or don't happen based purely on what the agent thinks or doesn't think.
Okay. All right. Michael Osaki is here. BaseballInTheAttic.com is the website. You can go there and get all the information you would need to contact Michael. But we're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to start talking to you. 312-981-7200. If you have a piece of memorabilia at home and you want to ask Michael about it, this is your chance. He is here until 7. So we will talk to you right after we do this on WGN. Got a piece of sports memorabilia? Well, you are in luck. Certified sports memorabilia appraiser Michael Osaki is here. BaseballInTheAttic.com is his website. Let's get started, shall we? You ready, Michael? You ready to tell some people either they have something wonderful or just hang on to it for fun?
I'm ready.
All right, let's go to Lincoln Park. We'll start with Joan. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you got?
I've got two things. I've got an autographed Mickey Mantle baseball with authenticity and forensic evidence papers.
Ooh.
And then I have a framed 5-photo collage of the National Baseball Hall of Fame original 5 inductees. There are 5 individual photos of Ruth, Johnson, Mathewson, Wagner, and Cobb, each of which has the National Baseball Hall of Fame certification.
That's a listen, I'm going to let you talk, Michael, obviously, but just hearing that, I go, this must be pretty cool. As you're answering Joan's question, will you explain the forensic paperwork that she says she has on this baseball?
Yep, and so she had... It was her question was a two-parter. So the second parter, those big 5 that were inducted in the late 1930s are obviously huge when it comes to baseball. I don't exactly know what the item is, so if you send me a picture, michael@baseballintheattic.com, I'm happy to take a look. Going back to the first part of your question about the Mickey Mantle with forensic documentation and a letter. Okay. So an authentic, genuine signed Mickey Mantle baseball could be anywhere from $300 to $500. A photo, $200 to $300. Now, the problem or issue with either forensic documentation or letters, the people that sign off on these a lot of times are essentially John Doe's, right? So, for example, let's say the host of this show, Brian Noonan, tomorrow signs 250 letters saying that this Mickey Mantle autograph is real. It doesn't mean that it's real because Brian hasn't studied enough Mickey Mantle autographs to know if it's real or not.
Sure.
So over the past 20 years, I see a lot of items, especially when they have a forensic document examiner. There was one guy years ago, and I'm drawing a blank on his name, I think Prouty in Kansas or Oklahoma. All those are bad, fake autographs. So in this particular example, if you email me the letter and a photo of the baseball, I'll be able to tell you if it's good or not.
How can people protect themselves, Joan included? How do we know then if we buy this and we have paperwork? Because I hear Joan tell me this, I'm like, well, it's got documentation. This must be legit.
Yeah, you have to do your research and background on the person that signed off on the letter, right? You can't just buy something and when the seller sells it to you saying that this comes with a forensic letter of documentation, you can't just assume that it's real and authentic. You have to do your due diligence on the person that signed off on that letter.
All right, well, Joan, send Michael a picture of that, michael@baseballintheattic.com, and he'll let you know for sure.
Got it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joan. All right. How about Paul? He is in Algonquin. Hi, Paul. Paul, you there?
Paul?
All right. We're going to put Paul back on hold. I don't know what happened to Paul.
I scared him.
Oh, he hung up. Joanne's in Chicago. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. How are you?
I am well. What do you have?
I have a brick. Then on the plaque it says, Original Comiskey Park Brick. 1910 to 1991, and it has, I guess, the says Speedway Wrecking
Company. Okay, so when they destroyed, when they tore down Comiskey, you bought one of these bricks.
Oh, I think I won it in a raffle or something like that.
Yeah, back in the late 1990s, the White Sox actually did have an auction where they auctioned off a lot of former, I should say, old Comiskey Park items, seats, seat backs, bricks. On a side note here, I actually have a couple of bricks myself.
Ah.
Not from an auction, but because I went with my family to a game when the old Comiskey Park was being torn down. And my brother and I reached underneath the fence and took a couple bricks for ourselves.
Wow.
And so I still have them. But
yours doesn't have the cool plaque on it that Joanne's does.
It doesn't.
But I would say with the cool plaque, $40 to $50.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Not bad.
Okay.
Well, see, Joanne sounds happy with that. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joanne. You are welcome. Bill has been hanging on. He's in Kingston. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
We're well. What do you got?
I have a unicorn, I believe. I have a car that I had to mail in a certificate to receive back when Dale Earnhardt passed away in the race that he passed away in. It was made by Nabisco as a, I guess you would call it a sponsorship car or a promotional car. You could buy the same car in a toy store, but this one came in a plain white wrapper with all the stickers that were on the Oreo promotional car that they used in the race. Not, I don't believe he was in the Oreo car when he crashed, but it was the same car, same stickers that were used for the promotional car for the race. I cannot find another one. About every 6 months, I get online, I search, I try every combination. I have emailed NASCAR enthusiasts who come up empty. I have no idea what to do with this. it's been on my shelf. He died 20 some years ago.
What do you think,
it's been
Michael?
On the top shelf of my closet for that long.
So sometimes you have to say, if you don't know, you don't know. And in this case, Brian, I don't know either, which is definitely not going to help you.
Right.
Again, send me a picture of your email or text it to me, 312-379-9090. I'm happy to take a look, but I just don't know right now.
Wow. Well, Bill, you may actually have that unicorn.
372-9090?
It's 379-9090, 312-379-9090.
Or Michael at baseballintheattic.com.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and send that to you anyways, just because
he might.
I could hit another roadblock.
Because there might be, you know, Michael's got a lot of connections in the memorabilia world. You never know who you're going to come across that might know. Bill, good luck. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Bill.
All right. We got to take a quick break. Then it's news time. If you are on hold, we are going to get to you right after the news. If you're trying to get through, 312-981-7200. We will talk more with Michael from Baseball in the Attic and find out if you have a real unicorn, if you have something that is a treasure, or if you have just a nice memory. All of that after this, WGN. Enough of me dancing. Let's get to this. But I want to do a text first because from the 630, what is the value of an Ernie Banks baseball signed with his name and Medal of Freedom?
So an Ernie Banks signed baseball by itself is about $100, but that inscription is pretty unique and rare because Obama gave that to him, I believe, in November of 2013, and Banks passed away in January of 2015. And so there was only a limited time for him to sign that. And even so, during that limited time, every day he wasn't signing with that inscription. People would have to ask him specifically. So I would double the price of that ball from $100 to $200.
Oh, wow. Very good.
With that inscription.
What if does it change if you have a baseball with a player and then like a lot of – when I have a Jack Buck signed ball, and it has HOF on it. He wrote HOF on it. Does that – does the Hall of Fame not from my ball, but from balls in general?
Usually it does. If you get something signed by a Hall of Famer and they add the Hall of Fame inscription with the – they usually will add HOF and then plus
and
the
then
year.
And then the year,
that's usually pretty good. In most cases, it'll increase it. It'll never go down usually.
Right. Okay, let's get back to the phones, 312-981-7200. People are waiting patiently. Jack is in Wilmette. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you, fellas?
We're great. What do you got?
I've got a Cubs scorecard, and it says, and I have it framed, so it says scorecard, fourth game, postseason series games, Cubs versus Athletics at Chicago, 1910.
Ooh.
I got this from my dad, who was born in that year. And then the funniest thing, gentlemen, is on the left side of the scorecard, it says Frank A. Vogler, Republican candidate for sheriff.
Very nice.
And it says election day, Tuesday, November 8th, 1910, polls open from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m.
So you go to the game and then go and vote. So what do you think, Michael? This sounds pretty interesting.
That's a great item. And I've been doing this a long time. You know, there's certain things that kind of, you know, get me excited. And this is definitely something that would be really interesting to see.
Because you specialize in the vintage stuff, right?
Yeah, my expertise is 1870 to 1970. The reason why it stops at about 1970 is because in most cases, the things from the 70s and the 80s were mass produced.
Okay.
And also when it comes to a card, whether football, baseball, basketball, hockey, the printing presses changed a lot in the mid-70s where they could mass produce these items around the clock, 365 days, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, but going back to this gentleman's question, it's several hundreds of dollars for sure. I'd love to see the condition. If it's in really nice condition, it would go up. Just send me an email, michael@baseballintheattic.com.
Wow, so it's a valuable piece then, Jack.
Okay, Michael at what?
At baseballintheattic.com.
Okay, I want you to also know it has a name of a printer on here. It says Allied Printing Trades Union Council.
That sounds very cool, Jack.
And then on the back, it has a listing of all the players and the manager.
It's really cool, Jack. I'm glad you called today. Send me an email, okay?
Yeah, send Michael a picture of that, and he'll let you know. But it sounds valuable. Thank you, Jack. Now, that's pretty cool. When something like that comes along, that's got to be, one, it sounds fairly rare, and it's right up your alley with the vintage stuff.
Yeah. So the first thing that crossed my mind is it's going to be a reprint, right, because I've seen a lot of reprints. But I don't think it is because he said his dad was born in that year. So
Right. Obviously
his dad got it a long time ago since he was born in that year.
Right.
It was sentimental to him.
Yeah.
So this sounds like a real genuine item here.
That's very cool. All right, let's get back to the phones. And to Naperville we go. That's where Audrey's been hanging on. Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
What do you got?
I probably don't have a unicorn. I have inherited a bunch of old hockey cards from my younger brother who passed away. And they're from the 70s.
Okay.
I have handfuls of them.
Okay. So it sounds like maybe a few hundred. Generally speaking, individually, there's not going to be a lot of value there, but because you have maybe some quantity, there could be some value there depending upon who the players are. So again, if you just give me a call or shoot me an email, I can kind of spend some more time with you and figure out if it's something that has value or not.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah,
All right. Thank you, Audrey. Give that number again, Michael.
My phone number is 312-379-9090. So 312-379-9090. I'll be available for a couple hours this evening. Or michael@baseballintheattic.com. And please be sure to follow me on Facebook.
All right. Let's go to Paul in Algonquin. We got Paul back. Hello, Paul.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you got?
Okay, I have from the Sands Hotel, a full-size craps cloth from the craps table.
Oh, wow. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I went in a silent auction for a charity event, and ever since then, I've always had it up on my wall, and we just took it down, and I'm just curious if that has any value to it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Obviously, the Sands Hotel has been, it's not there anymore.
Gone for a while.
Yeah, it's been demolished. But it's kind of a unique item. It's not that often I see something like that. It's going to be at least $125, $150, if not more, depending upon condition, the color. Are there any holes in it? Things like that. But again, I think this is a pretty unique item.
Now, so 150, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. Is it framed, Paul?
No, it's not. That's what we took it down. I had it actually spread out across the entire wall.
Okay.
It's a huge cloth. And then we just took it down because repainting and stuff, so I was going to get it framed. And but when I heard you guys talking tonight, I'm like, yeah, find out if it's worth anything.
Yeah. Now, well, It's worth something, but probably, Michael, and I don't mean to speak for you, it sounds like something that's a cool item to keep, maybe.
Yeah, I'm a Rat Pack fan, so I have a lot of their
stuff
and a lot of their autographs, and that's one of the reasons I got it.
Ah,
sometimes the issue with something like this, if it's really large, it's tough for a collector to buy it because, you know, if you think about your
right,
home.
Where are you going to put it?
Exactly. There's only so much space. And so sometimes we think that things are worth a lot of money, but when it comes down to actually selling it, it's not as worth it as much as we think because of the size is just so large.
So it has some value, but probably more value to you.
Yeah, right, Paul, no, well, it sounds like it does.
Yeah, it's very cool, though.
Appreciate
Paul.
It.
Thank you for the call. Yeah, because I was going to ask, what's, you know, how do you find a market for something like that? How do you, say Paul had come to you and you he'd said, I'm interested in selling this. How do you find a buyer for something as unique as what Paul had?
I get people that email me or call me every single week with different wants, needs.
Okay.
It's not just sports. People, because since I'm in the business, I've been doing it for a long time. People, I have a whole Rolodex of I shouldn't say gamblers, but people that collect gambling / casino items.
Okay.
And so they'll always tell me, if you ever find anything related to gambling, please give me a call because I may be interested in it. So in this particular case, Paul should contact me because I may have someone, if he did want to sell, that may be interested in it.
Okay. Well, Paul, then get a hold of Michael. Michael at baseballintheattic.com. And, you know, then he can always field some offers and see, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, very good. So, Paul, get a hold of Michael that way. Let's see. We will talk to Kathy in Libertyville. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're great.
Hey, great. Oh, I have a John Hamm bobblehead, St. Louis Cardinals bobblehead, signed by John Hamm. I had him sign it on the bottom in the original box. What would that be worth, do you think?
Well, John Hamm, the actor. But the Cardinals, the Cardinals did a bobblehead of him?
Yep. And about 3 years ago.
All right.
That's an interesting item. And
it is pretty interesting.
And Kathy's calling from Libertyville. I've been to the Starbucks there on Milwaukee Avenue. It's a great little place.
It is a great little place.
But that's a side note. Okay, so I don't think she wants me to talk about the Starbucks, does she?
No, probably not.
Sure,
what's this?
We can talk baseball up there anytime. Oh, why don't the two of you guys come on up?
All right. So what about this John Hamm? Because he's not a player, but it was put out through the team.
Yeah. And Kathy, I can't remember, is this signed or not signed?
Yeah, I had him sign it on the bottom.
Okay, between $40 and $50.
Huh.
All right, that's enough for some coffee.
There you go.
There you go.
There you go. Well, good luck, Kathy. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Kathy.
Yeah, so those things, if it's signed, it's still in the box, somebody's going to think that's cool, especially because it's not one of the usual player bobbleheads.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's unique. It's different. People like that. It's small. Doesn't take up a lot of space.
Yeah, very cool. Let's head up to Milwaukee. That's where Al's been hanging on. Hi, Al.
Hey, guys.
What do you got?
Okay, so I have a Major League Baseball autograph by Ron Santo, and I went to his Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Obviously, he was deceased, but I brought the ball with me, and there was a like a ceremony that the radio station did for him. So I had autographs from Fergie Jenkins and Ernie Banks, Randy Hundley, and Glenn Beckert, the players that were there for, like, to reminisce about stories. What would something like that be worth?
Okay, so it sounds like there's 5 signatures on the ball. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I've got all the Cubs players that were there. I did not get Billy Williams. But, yeah, for sure the players that I mentioned.
Okay, it's going to be worth between $100 and $150.
Okay.
Wow, not bad, Al.
So did I add to the value, given that I already had a Ron Santo ball, or does it take away from the fact that
that's a good question?
Yeah, you actually added to the value a little bit, because a Ron Santo single sign baseball is under $100. But the key one here is you added Ernie Banks. That's a good one. Glenn Beckert, not so great, but you have some of the other Hall of Famers from the Cubs as well, so that's good.
Fair enough.
Well, Beckert was his roommate, as I recall.
Yep.
Yep. Well, that's it sounds like you got a good deal up there, Al.
Cool. Thank you, guys.
You're very welcome. So, in general, is it better to have one single autograph, or if I get the team, do I need everybody?
Okay.
Or do I just need the big guns on that team?
Generally speaking, if you're getting a signed photo, baseball, whatever it is, bat, basketball, of a championship team, that's great. It's perfect.
Okay.
But if you're just getting one signature, one signer, like Anthony Rizzo, that's great. But if you have Anthony Rizzo, the third base coach, and Tommy La Stella, that's not good.
Okay.
It's going to decrease the value a lot. A lot of people think that the more signatures they get on an item, the better. That's in very rare cases, that's the case.
Okay.
In the previous example, as I said, if it's a championship team, that's great. But normally, no. Normally, I see a hodgepodge of, you'll see like one or two Hall of Famers and like eight nobodies. Sometimes also over many years, it definitely decreases the value.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll try to get to some more of your calls with Michael from baseballintheattic.com on the other side. Michael at baseballintheattic.com if you want to email Michael and send him a picture, and he can help you right at the website. If you do not get through, Michael, how can people get a hold of you? What's your phone number there?
It's area code 312-379-9090. Or Michael at baseballintheattic.com, or on Facebook at Baseball Attic. You can message me or follow me, and I'll get a hold of you that way.
And you got the website all redone. It looks good, baseballintheattic.com.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, let's see. What do we got? We will start with where is he? I see something up there, but it's not on the list. Well, we'll just go with Carolyn in Westchester. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
We are great. What do you got?
I've got a baseball card for Mickey Mantle.
Oh.
Do you know what year?
It's a 1959 All-Star card from the Sporting News Bazooka Gum, and it's numbered 564.
Yep, that's a great set, and there's a lot of Hall of Famers on the back end of that set. Willie Mays, the list goes on and on. That card ranges anywhere from $25 to $300 to $400, depending upon condition. When I say condition, how sharp are the corners, the centering, all that good stuff.
Oh, okay. Sounds good.
That's pretty good, Carolyn.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so when they're judging condition, is it better? I mean, a lot of old cards, they didn't put them in the sleeves and that kind of stuff, right?
No, and not only that, don't forget, there was no quality control, really, in the 1950s when they came off the printing press. So you see a lot of cards that are off-centered, top to bottom, left to
right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll go to Gary in Hoffman Estates. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Brian.
What do you got?
Well, I got something unusual here. I've got from 1962. I've got 12 of these. They're 6 by 6 inches. They're actual baseball cards that you play on a phonograph.
Baseball cards that you can play on a phonograph.
Oh, I think I know. Are these green in color? Is it green?
The borders are green, but yeah. I believe I have 12. And I don't know how many is in a set, but I believe every one of these cards is a Hall of Famer.
Yeah,
and most of them even have the hole punched out to put on a record player.
It's got
the bio on the back. It's got a very nice 6 by 6 inch photo of the player, a bio history on the back, and a year by year. Of what he did during the majors.
What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, the most valuable here in the set is the Mickey Mantle, and that can be worth $40 or $50. The rest of them, you're looking at between $10 and $20.
Wow, not bad. Sounds pretty good, Gary.
I've never seen any before. Were there more made than the 12 I have? Because I've got Whitey Ford, Frank Robinson, Don Drysdale.
Yeah, it's a small set. Yeah, so the set's very small. And I don't know if you have duplicates or not, but again, if you have, let's say, 12 of them, if I do some quick and dirty math, 12 times $20 is $240.
Yeah, not bad. All right, Gary, thank you for the call. Let's see. I'm trying to see what we've got here. Let's talk to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Mike, you there? What do you got?
Yeah, I've got a program that was put together by a group of friends that held a dinner for Don Larson when he returned to Michigan City, where he had lived for a while. So my father-in-law was his childhood friend, and he passed on this program. And it's unique in the sense that somebody, sort of a homemade thing, but it had play-by-play for the entire game, the box score, the scorecard, Eleanor write-up, and it was only distributed at that dinner. It was well documented in the local newspapers. Of course, you know, I was just a little kid when that happened.
All right, Mike, I'm going to interrupt you because we're up against the news, but I'll let Michael answer.
What do you think?
Yeah, of course, it's going to be worth a lot more money if it's autographed. If it's not autographed, at least $15 to $20.
All right. Well, there you go, Mike. Appreciate you. You are very welcome. Michael, it is always a pleasure to see you. Give that phone number again.
312-379-9090. 312-379-9090.
Or Michael at Baseball in the Attic. You can follow him on Facebook as well. Always good to see you. So the people who were still on hold, get a hold of Michael through the website baseballintheattic.com. All right, let's do this. Then we'll see what Karen's got cooking. It's WGN. All right, thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of the program. And look who has wandered in. Karen Conti is here. She's got a big show coming up next. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well, Brian. How are you?
I'm dandy.
Except I left Wisconsin this morning with 4 inches of snow on my lawn.
This is
what
ridiculous. I am not I am not happy. I am not impressed. I don't know what Mother Nature's deal is. But and I just keep thinking in a few days I'll be in Louisiana where it'll be nice and warm and sunny.
Well, thank you for that. I'm glad you're
going to
be happy.
So I get to be happy for a day. I deserve a day of happiness, Karen. What's on the big show tonight?
Oh, we're talking to Heather Steens, who's a state senator, about the Equal Rights Amendment. We're trying to pass it again one more time. And then I'm talking to Daniel.
It still hasn't passed?
No.
What is this, 1976?
It's a simple amendment that just says women are going to be treated equally. Why can't we pass that?
I think we know. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Are you behind the opposition?
I am,
Brian?
Behind the times.
Okay, me too. Get it. Me too. No, we're gonna also talk to Daniel Pink, an author of a book about when. It's all about timing. It's fascinating. He's got all these theories about there's a good time to do things and a bad time to do things.
All right. Well, as I mentioned before, we will not be here next week because I will be gone, but we will talk to you very, very soon. Thanks again for being part of the program. This is Chicago's very own 720 WG in Chicago. If you have a smart speaker, praise it for its intelligence and good looks, and then just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. The news is sponsored by Next Door and Window. Little bit after 7, it's Roger Badish.